testing. One, two, three, four. Sounds out. Looks okay.
Working fine.
This is the.
That's the microphone.
That's the microphone. Okay.
Picks up very well, and I think we're all set.
Okay, your nickel.
Okay.
Take your coat off.
I think want I am,
to. Your shoes off.
It's a warm day.
Well, you're smart with short sleeves.
I just grabbed some shirts.
No, those are smart in the summertime. Why people wear long sleeves, I'll never know.
Well, let's begin. I know you were born on November 9th, 1924 in Brooklyn.
Correct.
And you were the youngest of three.
Right.
I read a lot about your father, but could you start by telling me something about your mother?
My mother was born in Eagle River, Wisconsin, one of five. Five children in a little town up in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. It was a lumber town. In fact, later in life, my father bought a place up there. We used to spend summers even as a kid because my mother, I say, was one of five. The eldest two, following tradition of families, went to work at the family store. My grandfather had a, I guess you call it a soft goods store, you know, shoes and dresses and cloth and things like that for this little town up in Eagle River, Wisconsin. The eldest two went to work in the store, and the other three, don't ask me how they did it, the other three went to college.
Hmm.
One uncle was a doctor, one uncle was a dentist. My mother graduated University of Wisconsin and was a school teacher. And she went back to this little town of Eagle River, Wisconsin to teach. It was a one-room schoolhouse. Small. To this day, there's only 1,491 people. When you drive to Eagle River, the sign says 1,491 people. So I don't know how many kids they had in school 50, 60 years ago or more. I'm trying to think. She was born in 1892, so she was teaching. She probably graduated college around... my father was born in 1892. She was born in 1896. So she probably was graduating from college 1917, around then, and probably taught all grades. She taught 12 grades.
Mm.
She was the only school teacher. It was one-room schoolhouse. And whatever child came in, she taught. She was a math major, but minored in other things. So she used to tell stories when somebody would ask a question, say, in history. She'd always say, that's the head of the class, she just got to wait, we'll cover that next week. And at night she'd go home and study that. So she studied with the students. And so that's her background, was a University of Wisconsin school teacher. Met my father at a wedding where her roommate from college, she attended the wedding, her roommate from college married at that time my father's boss, who was the chemical salesman. The two of them met at, I'm trying to think of his name, I'll think of it later on. I get old, you start forgetful. They met at the wedding, and 41 days later, my mother and father were married.
Mm.
My father was impetuous, get it done. He was not impatient. So 41 days after they were married. And then, of course, they will cover later on, they moved to New York. But she was from a small town in Wisconsin. A wonderful woman. Loved to fish. Some of the picture down the wall because of the move, but that's her with her fishing guide.
Oh, yeah.
Catching fish in Wisconsin. And those two pictures over there are my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary in 1929.
Mm.
So that would have, and then it's 1929, covering the five children. He went to work in the store, married them there. And she went to work in the store and married there. He's the doctor. Traveled with John Philip Sousa.
Really?
Banned when the flu, the influenza was killing everybody.
Yes.
In World War One.
Right.
And the books about John Philip Sousa covering it. Dr. Frankel was the band doctor, and nobody got sick. He was a dentist out of Milwaukee. He was a doctor. It was my mother and my father. And all the little kids. So that's
very nice.
Okay.
It goes back a long time.
Yeah, that goes back. It's good. That's what history's about.
Yes. Well, you've written in that Newcomen address about your father and how he arrived in this country when he was, what, four?
Right.
Something like that. I was curious when he went to work, or he went to school at Armour. That was just a... what, the beginning of World War One, sometime in there?
Yeah, he was born in 1892, so he was at Armour Tech. For a fact, there's a picture, I think, of him in 1914 as a chemist. So, yeah, it was just before World War One. And remembering that the chemical industry in World War I or before was all German. There was no American chemical industry. You know, the dye stuffs and the pigments and the sophisticated things all came from Germany. We had, of course, sulfur and caustic soda, things like that, but nothing was really sophisticated.
Why did he get that, have that interest in chemistry?
Well, the story he tells, which I believe, he was went into fire protection engineering. He had one arm. You know, he lost his arm. And he went into fire protection engineering, and which was a big thing, fires, the Chicago fire, and chemical industry was nothing. I guess the fire protection was very important. And the first semester in the wintertime, he was climbing, not ladders, but
fire escapes,
and he decided that wasn't for him. And he switched, and I guess that was about the only other thing, or one of the few things that that they offered was chemical engineering, because a poor Russian immigrant with one arm doesn't take chemical engineering in 1914 or whatever he took it. So, but he did. He switched from the fire protection engineering to chemical engineering. It's interesting. Armor Tech became Illinois Tech. My father was on the board of Armor Tech and Illinois Tech. He and a fellow named Harris Perlstein, who had Pabst, was the head of Pabst, was also a graduate. And when the Armor family in the 30s were going broke, couldn't support the school. It was named after the Armors, but they just physically, financially couldn't support it. But my father and Harris Perlstein put together a group of old alumni and picked up and kept that school going. So it was Armor Institute of Technology then, and my father, when he graduated from Armor, continued night school. That was again, and became a lawyer. And went to downtown school, which we still support, Kent College of Law. Kent and Armor, first Armor became Illinois Tech, and Illinois Tech merged Kent in with them as their law school too, so that both his law school and his undergraduate school became part of Illinois Tech. And he was on the Board of Trustees, I guess, almost till he died.
You commented also in that Lukeman address about how well he was able to function with only one arm from a young age.
Amazing.
Was he 7 or 8 when that
not
accident
that age,
happened?
Yeah.
And again, going into chemical engineering, working in a laboratory, that must be quite a challenge.
He tells stories of how he did it. He said the best thing ever happened to him, his mother wouldn't help him. Made him do everything for himself. When I used to doing things for yourself, you wear shoelaces, I don't. He was lazy. But shoelaces he always wore. He could tie shoelaces and ties, clean fingernails, eat. If you spent 10 minutes with him, I think you'd forget that he didn't have an arm. And the only thing that he needed help on in eating, the only thing that I think he needed help on in anything, he played a good game of golf, he played tennis, he drove cars when the shift was on the floor, you know, and he figured out ways to hold the wheel with his elbow while he did it. The only thing that he really needed help, and it killed him, is lobster.
Really?
You really can't eat lobster with one hand. You really can't hold it and do it. So with lobster, he let them take the meat out of the shell. Otherwise, he'd kill you if you went to help him. He developed ways to hold things that he had half an arm, so he could hold things underneath. And of course, then later in life, he developed himself a very lightweight arm himself. Didn't function except the fingers could, he could hold them open so it would hold cards. He was a fine bridge player, so that he could snap them open, put the cards in, and would hold the cards, then he could play bridge. It was just a short, very lightweight, with a glove on it, that made it easy for him.
Do you think that early experience helped his determinism?
Definitely.
Through life?
He was the most determined man I ever knew. He really was. Very bright man.
Do you know why he pursued a law degree after he had his chemistry degree?
I don't know. I guess it was just a habit of work. I remember in those days, we go and we watch television. I don't think they had radio. I don't think there was radio. I can remember a car radio in 1929 when we'd pull along the side of the road and listen to Eddie Canderson on Sunday night or something like that. But
now, around the First World War, I don't think
people had radio.
No, I don't think it was commercial radio.
So there was nothing to do at night. You read a paper, you read a book, the family, but there were no diversions. So the school was just sort of a normal way of life, of competing education continuing. Well, there was no obstacle that he felt he couldn't surmount.
Mm-hmm. Well, that you certainly made that point clear when you described the fire. That
it's true.
That
it's a true story. The fellow whose wedding he went to was Max Wallenberg. That was his boss, and his wife. I don't know. Of course, Mrs. Max Wallenberg. My mother's roommate married my father's boss, Wallenberg, in Chicago.
Now that was at Dager.
A Dager, yeah.
Yep. Okay. But before that, after he was at, he spent a couple of years at a couple of different places,
right,
before he went after. Well, the fire was at, not at Dager, but at
it was the flour, big flour warehouse.
Yes,
the flour. That's when he was working as a chemist in somebody's little laboratory. It wasn't Dager. And the fire, I told the story, he went to answer the phone. He was a production foreman, chemist, sales, a little bookkeeping too in those days. He answered the phone, and they were, at that time they were using, I guess, buying a carnauba wax, I think it was, some type of wax. And he went to the library there in Chicago and found a formula, blending all, it was a blend of two waxes, so he got some samples. Put the two waxes together to see if they would do it under the Bunsen burner, and when he went to the phone, the wax came over, caught fire, dribbled, caught fire, that redded space, and the big fire was next door with the complete flour warehouse just long.
Did how long between that and the time he got the job with Dager? Was he unemployed, or did he?
Well, they were married. I'm trying to think when they were married. He must have been working for Dager in 1920. They were married in 1920. He graduated school probably around 1914. So he worked. The company was founded in 1920. They were married in 1918. Married in 1918, the company was founded. So he worked for about 4 years for other people, different jobs, and then got married and struck out on his own.
Why going out on his own, and how did he meet the Tumpiers?
I don't know. Through in Chicago, how he met the Tumpiers, through somebody. Tumpiers were two of the three. I showed you that picture of the three of them, but all three didn't start at the same time. The company was founded in May of 1920, and my father owning 51%, the two Tumpier, the older two. One was an inside man, a sort of administrator you'd call today, but was a fishing guy, order processing, records, books, salesman, or watching sales expenses. Julius was a great, the eldest brother, Julius Tumpier, was a great salesman. I didn't know Julius. He retired before I came to work with the company. But Julius, they say, was one of the greatest salesmen ever alive. So he was the outside man. Day was the inside man. My father was the businessman, I guess, and also covered, Julia, my father covered Akron and the rubber. Got to remember, there was no plastic industry.
Right.
Chicago in those days was tanning, you know, leather chemicals, ink. There was a lot of printing done in the Midwest. Sears, Roebuck, Catalina, a lot of printing companies there. No rubber. But the products that they jobbed in those days had some application for rubber. Fillers, clays. And very small rubber, some rubber processing, a little belting, some hosing, but rubber was Akron. So my father covered the major accounts in Akron, which were big volume accounts. The Julius Tumpier covered Minnesota and Illinois and I guess Indiana, places like that. So they started the two brothers. How he met them? I guess through people. He had a good friend. If you want to know, we've got an old timer I'm going to see in 2 weeks. His name is Jerome Harrison, but he was part of the Tumpier family. He's 82 and retired now. I'm taking him to Las Vegas. I always give him a vacation now and then. We go personally with another old employee. When I first started with the company, he was very nice to me. I started working in Chicago with Jerome Harrison. Jerome Harrison's brother, or cousin, was a doctor. I. Harrison Tumpier. Don't ask me. And I. Harrison Tumpier was also a stockholder, original stockholder of the company. Original of the Tumpiers, 49% was split up, and Dr. Tumpier had some stock. So I got a feeling that my father knew I. Harrison Tumpier, socially probably met him when he was working. And he had some cousins. He wasn't a brother of the two Tumpier brothers, or the three Tumpier brothers, and they met. And Julius was, I don't know if Julius had sold before, but my father had some capital he'd saved, got In those days, people saved.
They didn't go to Las Vegas
and spend. So they saved up. The original capital, I think, was $50,000. I think they put it to the
really?
Start. Wow. Tumpier Brothers, the two of them, and the doctor, who was I, Harrison Tumpier, collected $24,000 or whatever, $24,500. My father saved $25,000 or borrowed, if he did. And that was the original capitalization company.
That's a good sum of money for that time.
Yeah. I guess as a jobber, yeah, they bought carloads and sold LCLs. So it isn't like today you represent, they were true representatives. They don't have to take any credit risk, carry inventory, just to know a rep. But in those days, they were true jobbers. They bought that. They bought out of a warehouse. I got some pictures here of some really old trucks. I mean, beautiful picture of real old trucks with the Dave Wishton up here on the old chain driven trucks. They had a deliverer in the area. So they had to buy a truck. They had to get a warehouse. And when they bought, they had to pay their bills. I guess my father was always also a very shrewd or a very smart financial man. He always believed in getting money when you didn't need it. Because when you do need it, you may not get it. We've always, as a company, inventory money. We borrowed a couple of years ago $150 million at 5.5%. Didn't need it. We had money in the balance sheet. That's why I think we grew, because money was never a problem in our company. Projects always were approved. Since I've been with the company, there's nothing that's never been not approved. We always have, if you look at our balance sheet, you'll always see $150 million of cash or equivalents. Now we're down. We just bought Soto chemical operations in Soto for $65 million, and last year I bought in $24 million of our stock. And they said, well, we had authorization to buy in $100 million. And they said, why didn't you do it? I said, when we were working on the DeSoto, it was a bidding game. I didn't know if we were going to buy it or not, so we followed the process of buying in our stock. But the minute it was a done deal, or almost a done deal with DeSoto, quit buying the stock. Bought DeSoto instead, but used up almost $100 million. 65 and 24. And I still, even to this day, I'm still looking as of today. Although our balance sheet shows $84 million cash at the end of March. Cash. I'm not talking inventory, they're talking cash. We're still in the finance committee meeting next week. I feel we should go and get another $100 million. Get it? Well, you can get it. Interest rates are down, stock prices are up. So that's where we've built the company. We built the company by internal growth and acquisitions, and always had the money. So I said, it was a lot of money in 1920, yeah. When it was soundly financed, they always felt pay the bills. So that the $50,000, when you buy a truck and you get an office and you start buying a carload of this and a carload of that and bring them into the warehouse, you're going to pay the bill. Now you're going to slowly sell them out. That's why he always was, me too, but it was crazy on inventory. Crazy, I think, in the company to keep inventories down. Because he went through not having the money or needing the money to buy the next girl.
How many employees did he have when they started out?
Glad you asked. I've gone through some of his old papers here. Lots of, in those days, of course, now we don't save anything. The government, my secretary won't let me save nothing. If I confirm something to you, she may throw everything away. Every year, this is 91, she brought in 89 files are finished. But now, I've got here a list of every employee when they went public. They went public in 1958. Again, in this old this files I found. And it's interesting. I knew everybody by name. Mm. Almost everybody by first name. I never counted them, but in 1958, and by then we had, look at the annual report, had factories having this and that. Well, it was show location. We didn't have that many people.
What are you going to do to preserve these papers?
I give off and on to our people here for our archives.
Okay, so you do have a company archive.
Yeah.
That's good.
Stuff like this. Everybody went to war in the World War and World War II. He wrote to send everybody a present, told everybody their job was held for them, and the answers here are really great. Almost everyone answered in 1944, 45, long hand or V-mail or anything else. Somewhere in Italy, so interesting. He was very considerate. Let me get this down. He was all company. never drew more than $48,000 life on this company.
My God.
It shows pensions right here. And I just had it. It must be over here. I must have kept it out.
Here it is.
Here is the founder of the company. Very generous. Never had much money. And
1952, Republican 1958. His pension benefits, $500 a month. And was a consultant, $10,000 a year. That's all he wanted.
He was the boss. I'm sorry. He was the boss.
That's amazing.
That isn't today, is it?
Yeah.
That's even with me, including me, that's the same today.
Because that's before inflation, but in 58.
Still, I mean, considering everything, that's still not...
Pension was 500 and 10,000 he took. Here's the... you say, how many employees do they have? I don't know, but I would say that they had no more than... they had the one office. That the two tuppiers of my father were three. I'm sure there must have been a girl's four. Maybe a bookkeeper, maybe not an accountant, maybe six or seven people they started with. I'm sure if I know my father, he just started with the two tuppiers himself. And then they worked their way into a secretary. 1958. If you want any copies of any of this, I'd be happy to make them.
Oh, yes, if you don't mind.
But 1958, August 20th. Sales office, Akron. Plant office, Boston. These are sales office. Ripon plant up on the fourth floor of Bush Terminal here. This industrial, I don't know if you know Bush Terminal.
Yes.
Making steerings, metallic subs. The warehouse for the jobbing items. We did our own trucking, Chicago office, which were sales and some purchasing. By then we had the Chicago plant. Chicago plants, we had Chicago plant in 58. Chicago plant research, Houston office, Lawrenceville was an asphalt plant in 2. Glenwood was a, California was a little small plant we bought from, which a paint company were 3. Perth Amboy was on location of 4. And that's it. I mean, a little plant we started in Canada, Stereo plant. So we have 4 locations. And if you want copies, I'm happy to make. You want?
Yes, I'd like copies of that sheet.
Okay.
Would you mind a copy of
this? No, no problem. This is the agreement, I guess. This is the agreement. What are you going to get?
It's absolutely amazing.
I take it back. See, he wasn't stupid. Let's see. Now this was he was frugal. This was 1957, but his compensation for the service agreed to be rendered. Whitco paid Mr. Wish a sum of $20,000 per annum for the remainder of his life, effective January 1, 1962. So the first 5 years, he took $10,000 a year, but then he covered himself in case of inflation, quarterly installments for the rest of his life. So he did. He took $10,020. After 5 years.
In 62 he would have been 70.
He was born 1892, yeah. 62 he would have been 62 and 70. Yeah.
70.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'll get the copies of those.
What was the question? How many employees we got?
Well, that's...
How many we had? It's funny, I knew everybody here personally. I can add these up.
When we went public, this is the day we went public, and we went public in May of 58. And these were all the employees of the company. And I'd worked in every location practically. All the sales offices worked for me. I was in charge of the chemicals division, which was the Chicago and Perth Amboy plant. And I knew everybody by first name, the whole company.
Mm. By comparison, what is the company today?
Too many.
Okay.
My father used to go to, as he got older, it was hard for him to comprehend. You know, it's one thing running a business. Another thing, building. And when you build, you need sometimes some long-range planning. We'd go have a Christmas party. In those days, we were fairly small. And you look around, and once we bought companies, we bought Argus and Brooklyn, and we brought them over to the park. You look around and say, who are all these people? And I said, well, those are from Argus, and that's from people coming in from Sonneborn. We bought Sonneborn in 1960, big company, Sonneborn Chemical Refining. And he said, do they all work like that? I said, they all work for the company. But he said, do me a favor, fire one.
He said, can't the company get along with one less person? I said, you're right. There's always, you know, one less person.
And I said, you know what, you're building the future. If things get tough, we will. But I said, right now, I'm going to keep building for the future. But he could never end it. A lot of people, a lot of non-productive people, salespeople he loved. Whenever sales things were tough, he offered the sales department, anybody who wears out, wear out shoe leather. He said, get holes in your shoes, I'll buy you new shoes. To this day, I have bets in the company with shoes. But he loved salespeople. He just couldn't understand, as business got more complex, the problems of the departments that we have here today, you know, like 21 people in safety, health, and environmental, and the legal departments. We know he never had a lawyer. You had a lawyer, you picked up the phone, you called your friend the lawyer. Now we got a patent lawyer, and I'm just talking here, we got an ecology lawyer. This, it's tough today. It really is for a small business. It's very difficult for small business to survive in this environment. You've got to be big to be able to afford the staff that you've got to have to exist, to stay alive. I don't know how a small $30, $40, $50 million sales company survives today with the amount of people that they need that are not productive. So how many people we had then? I'd say six in the beginning. We went public in 1950. I'll give you a copy of this and you can count them yourself.
Okay, sure.
But again, I say there's every one of these, you got a story. Every one. My God, there's a name I forgot. She was my secretary, Lady Grouse.
Okay.
I'm sure that's 33 years ago. 56, yeah, 33 years ago I went public.
Well, let's go back to the early days again.
Okay.
As I understand it, your father came to New York because one of the Tempeers didn't like it here and they switched?
Yeah, but he felt it was growing, New York was growing. Back after World War I, New York industries changed, New York Population Center. I guess paint was very big in New York. I remember they were choppers, distributors. And as they got a line, you just couldn't buy a car on the county, it had to be a bonafide distributor warehousing, so you wouldn't be double competition. Remember before I mentioned Chicago, I talked of tanning, I talked of some rubber. Paint was very ink I talked about, but not paint. For some reason, New York was the paint area. As they developed, got other lines that more towards paint, magnesium carbonate, some colors, siennas, numbers, and blank fix and things that went into paint. In those days, lithopone, before titanium dioxide was around, lithopone and stuff. Then they felt New York, he felt New York. And one of the top beers came here, Julius, I think. He wasn't here long, and he just didn't like New York. He liked there were Chicago people, brothers and family. So my father said, if you don't want to do it, I will. And that's when he came here. And I think the year was, they tell me, my brother, I know that my brother and sister were born in Chicago.
Okay.
But I was conceived in Chicago and carried and born in New York. So it must have been in the summer of 1924, okay, because I was born here in New York in 1924 in November. Thank you. I'm doing it. He's a good man just to show you, and he do it, too.
He was a tough guy. He was really tough.
Again, jumping around. He retired in 1958. We were public. He wanted to keep busy. He stayed with us. We had an office. I'm moving out. We want to move out, don't we, Dorothy?
Exactly.
He stayed. That's how he died. In 1988, he stayed in the office. And he wanted something to do. I don't pin me on the year. I have to pin you on your foot. He said, okay, international division, see what you want to know, give me something to do. He said, well, we got it, whatever. So boom, he jumped on the airplane, he went over, and within a year we had bought a company in England, we bought a company in France, I can't believe how fast we bought a company in Belgium, and we had a big international division within a year. He worked with the banks, he worked with consultants, and he found three or four companies that we got established, and I'll give you the year very quickly. In 1 year, we got to stand. I'm talking manufacturing. I'm not talking in sales. I mean, about 1959, 60, 61, he went over, and within a year, we had a ongoing. Then turned over the operations. That's when the problems started. But you know, with the prima donnas and the principals and the language problems and financing problems, he did it. I'll tell you. So he kept busy. So he came east. I'd say in the summer 24.
And over the years, this territory developed more. It became the international center, the banking center. Chicago stayed again the just manufacturing. I say we didn't have the, we had the one plant in Lawrenceville, 1924.
Was that the asphalt?
The asphalt plant. Pioneer Asphalt Company that was owned by Sir William Mackenzie of Canada. It was built in 1901 or 1903. Sir William Mackenzie of Canada owned the Pioneer Asphalt Company. They sold for them. The Wishnick-Tumpier were distributors. That's one of the few companies made what we call today MR, which is mineral rubber, a hard asphalt, very hard. Rocks like a rock, and the oxidized asphalt, when you take asphalt, you take a flux or a petroleum byproduct, blow air through. Within the air process, it actually oxidizes. The more air, and the longer you blow it, the more you blow it, the melting point goes up on the asphalt, and the penetration, which is the hardness, goes up and up and up. Whereas a normal penetration, based on, I won't get technical on how you measure penetration, it's in a fixed water bath and a fixed ball dropping through a certain distance, and the temperature must go up at a very steady rate so you don't get this. Today, flat or steep roofing and roofing asphalt will be 180 degree melt point, 160 degree melt point. MR, the mineral rubber, was over 300. I'm talking a rock. It was a rock. And it was actually oxidized to death, which is knocking out all the low ends of the volatile. That's exactly what the oxidation does. It changes the melting point and the hardness of it. Poured to big pans, let it solidify. The heat there is tremendous, and let it solidify for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days. And then you break it up, pickaxes in the old days, and put it through grinders. And boy, when I first went to work in 1950 in Perth Amboy, they were making MR. When you take hard asphalt and grinders, it gets in your, the fine dust gets in your hair, it's in your ears, and your nose, and there's no way to get it out. You can't put solvent's the only way to get out, kerosene. You can't really put kerosene up your ears. And I was a newlywed. I'd come home in my beautiful sheets in the morning. You'd see nothing but, I mean, shampoo didn't help the hair. Anyway, that was the first plant that was bought in 1924 from Sir William Mackenzie. They sold that to the rubber trade. It was used as a detackifier, or as an extender on compounding a rubber, when they compound rubber in Banbury's. They add the MR. Banbury's are hot, and there's a lot of shear to Banbury. You're familiar with what a Banbury is? And by putting the asphalt in there, it was really extending the rubber, but also adding certain softening properties to the rubber as the asphalt MR melted down. So they represented, knew the company, bought it in 1924. After 1924, as I read the files of the company, there was a slight, I wouldn't say fights, but a slight divergence between the Tumpiers and my father. I've got some legal files on it and some advice my father got. They didn't want to really go into manufacturing. They couldn't quite see putting the capital into fixed equipment. They liked the idea of buying, selling, buying, selling. Whatever's left over, you can keep. And you don't have any great fixed investment. My father always felt that manufacturing was the future. And although they stayed comfortable together all those years, I can see in the board minutes and this and that, and they were good friends. They got along fine. But the goals of the company between manufacturing and although it never came to it, my father, I see in the files, was prepared to go with 51%. Say, God damn it, that's it. It never came to that. But he got good legal advice what he could or couldn't do at the board level as ownership versus being outvoted. Two of them and one of them, by then there were three. They choked up here and come. So that was the goal of manufacturing. A lot of investment into equipment, inventories, receivables, people.
When was the one built in Perth Amboy?
Perth Amboy was built, again, I'll say this for the record. I've never been sued personally. I've never sued anybody personally. I've never been in court in my whole life, except as a juror. I gave one deposition once, and I have a very bad memory and can't remember anything. I don't keep any files, so that... I've never really given more than one deposition I can remember. Perth Amboy, that's why I bring up. And my father was the same way. Never been in court. Never sued anybody. Never been sued. And He felt that you better go settle and go back to work. Don't waste your time. He used to laugh at me when I wanted to go to court. I knew we were right. I want to go to the wall. I'll pay the bills, I'd say. I'll pledge all my stock. And some bitch isn't going to get away with it. I don't care if it costs me $1 million. I'm not going to pay the $50,000. They laugh at me. You want to have something to eat. So that's the kind of thing. He was a very practical man. Perth Amboy was built in 1947, 48. It was built adjacent to what is called California Refining Company. California okay. Refining still is there. The big plant is now mothballed. We were to take the flux and become their distributor for the whole Northeast area, including paving grades, not just hard asphalt, but all of asphalt. We were to be their asphalt distributor by taking and upgrading. They have a gasoline refinery, and we took all the asphalt bottoms. We built the plant, and by the time the plant was built, they changed their mind, and we were only to get asphalt flux for our own oxidation, roofing asphalt, but nothing to do with paving it, which is the big thing. Paving is 100 to 1 practically. And American Bitumens, which was their division, took over the marketing of their, and we had a big plant there and no sales. And again, look at the files, everybody was mad, but we didn't go to court. He wanted to go to court and change his mind and didn't go to court, and we built up an asphalt specialty business, what we did instead, small volume. And that's where I went to work in Perth Amboy after I started in Chicago at that plant. So that's when it was built in 48, started up in 49, I guess. Blew up in 49, started up in 50, blew up in 50. We kept blowing up. It was so fun. We'd get these flashes, and so much so that the tops of the stills, those asphalt stills, where they're oxidizing, when we rebuilt, was nothing but very heavy, extremely heavy welds, and nothing but practically chicken wire. You know, a chicken, when they put a blowout patches, the whole roof, you almost couldn't walk on it. It was so fragile, so that the explosions would pop. Boom, off would go the whole roof like a flying saucer, land, and those explosions, they never popped. We never could figure out why. They were just chicken wire with a little bit of asbestos and stuff on it. They still blew. So we had changed the whole process from horizontal stills to vertical stills.
Let me come back to your early life then for a moment. Yeah, we're going to probably end up jumping around because so many things are intertwined. But
I jump around on horse.
What was it like growing up in Brooklyn?
I loved it. I've always been a happy kid. Always was.
Where were you in Brooklyn?
858 East 24th Street. 24th Street to Hemingway in Brooklyn. And then again, typically, as you made a few more dollars, people moved from Flatbush to Eastern Parkway. You don't know Brooklyn now. Eastern Parkway is probably one of the worst areas of New York, Grand Army Plaza. It was the most magnificent. It was built like a French big rues, the big avenues in France. Just beautiful. So he made a little money, moved to Eastern Parkway, an apartment building, a two-family house. Made a little more money, then you went to Westchester. This is the Jewish trend out of New York City to New Rochelle, where I went to high school, and then I say first Mount Vernon and then New Rochelle, where my parents bought a house. I'll try to think. Let's see, I graduated high school in 42, about 1936 or 37. And the banks in those days swore they'd never lend more than 50% on anything, because we all got burned. Banks on the house. Right back doing it again. They get burned. No, he's right, officer. Because they loan more than 50% of value. Because the value of most of these properties haven't come down that much. But they meant 70, 80, 90%, sometimes 100%. Real estate people, with the prices going up and up and up, my son-in-law in California thinks he's a genius. He refinances his house. I say, you're buying more money. That's all you're doing. They say, you talk refi. You're buying deeper. Yeah, the banks are lending more and more. The value is more. And then when it turned down, then the banks can spend. So we built the house in 1937. That's when we finally settled in Rochelle.
Somewhere I read that you were quoted as saying that you always knew you were going to work for your father. How early did you have that feeling?
I started working when I was 12.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of 1924, it would be 1936 or 1937. Chemical Exposition in New York, Grand Central Palace.
Yes.
Grand Central Palace, nobody remembers it. There was an exhibition hall. I remember going Lexington Avenue, Grand Central Palace, and I was doing a little display booth and little jars of chemicals, you know, for the paint industry and plywood, but there was no plastic industry. And I was a page boy in blackface, called Philip Morris Johnny, starting at 12. And then the summers I'd work in a plant or a laboratory, and then Christmas vacation I'd go to the downtown warehouse and push barrels at Christmas. So I always.
What about your brother and sister?
Sister is an artist. She's in the art world. She's got the culture of the family. Really got great culture. Great culture.
I'm proud of her. Really proud of my little sister. Not my little sister.
Profile until recently, but in the music and contemporary music and contemporary art, she's been supporting musicians and artists for the last 30 years, like the Italians used to do it, and they've almost become very famous. She had very good taste in composers, artists.
Oh, gosh.
It's just the typical stuff. She's finally come out of the closet as a major supporter of avant-garde things. So she's got. She graduated from Wellesley. She's got all the culture. And my brother is his own boss. My brother likes things his own way. So he's not a corporate man.
He's an entrepreneur. He's now retired. But he was a little more entrepreneurial, doing things his way.
So he stayed away from the company.
Well, he was with the company for many years. He was the company in Texas. He was with the company in Chicago. He was in the company in New York. But it didn't work out. It did not work out. He wanted to do it his way.
He was on the board, though.
Oh, yeah.
And their sister, I think, was on the board.
No, she was never on the board.
She wasn't. Or her husband was on
the board. Her husband worked for the company. Okay. He was our West Coast manager. Did a very good job, and they got promoted to national sales manager here in the East, and within the first month, I knew it was wrong. Californians are a different way of life, I'm telling you. They don't work like we work here. You may laugh, but it's not.
No,
I've never been successful. I've very seldom been successful promoting people in California. Chicago, Houston, yes, but California, no.
That's fascinating.
Let me get a knife. Is that big enough sandwich for you?
That is.
That's a small size. Knife.
I think. Is there another?
Oh, it's in there.
Okay. There's one in here.
So my brother developed some entrepreneurial businesses. One which he sold to Zern Industries on hydraulic steering mechanisms and automatic bilge pumps for a marine industry. And he sold that to Zern and got into cars. He liked antique cars. Had a very big antique car museum.
So you decided...
Nepotism never played much here. I think I made it on my own because I was good, I think. And we never had any relatives. My father personally asked his son on auto leave when he wasn't working out too well. Same with my brother. And they never had any hard feelings. I mean, they just weren't happy working for the company.
But you worked.
I loved it. Up to a point. After 50 years or 40 years, it got tougher and tougher.
So you went to high school in New Rochelle?
Mm-hmm.
You have any schooling in Brooklyn?
Pardon me?
Do you have any schooling in Brooklyn? Early schooling?
So I don't remember. I remember Mount Vernon. In 1937, I moved to New Rochelle, which I was then 13, but before that we lived in Mount Vernon, Pelham Manor, Running. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I must have had a little school in Brooklyn. I just don't remember. It's amazing. I have a 15-year-old daughter now. Of course, I have grandchildren. But it's hard to realize when they're 4, 5, or 6. They're not going to remember one damn thing that happened to them, you know?
Yes.
They won't remember. Mm-hmm. At what age you really start remembering? 10, 11, 12, I guess. What's the earliest you really remember?
Well, I can remember things at 6, but only because it was a traumatic
little
experience.
Little things, but little I mean things. Everyday things.
No, you're right.
It's amazing. I don't remember the same thing, what I'm doing. I'm going to California on the 27th to see them, the 4 grandchildren. They won't remember.
Okay, that's life, though. You can't help it.
What about in high school? Do you have any special experience?
No.
Straightforward?
Just straightforward high school. Chase girls, didn't do too well. No sports. No Boy Scouts. I was not much of a student. I didn't really care for studying.
But you went to...
World War II came along, I was sort of happy. Got me out of school.
But you did go to Carnegie Tech before the Civil War started.
Yeah.
Why did you end up out there?
I went to look at different engineering schools. And the day I went to Pittsburgh, it's probably the one good day of the year they had that. Pittsburgh was a... awful town.
I've been there.
In the 40s and 50s until they started cleaning it up, which is now a nice town. But it was probably one good day. The Kilty Band was playing on the cut, the sun was shining, the girls were laying around watching the band. There was a little football field there. I said, what heaven? And it was close to New York. Mm-hmm. The old airport in Pittsburgh was on the Carnegie Tech side.
Okay.
The new airport, now you got to go through downtown,
right,
you've got
to
go all the way out. But the old airport, which is built on a slag heap, we built and smoked the airport, was only about 25 minutes. And that was on this side of town also, if you're driving back to New York. It was close, convenient, beautiful school, engineering school, small, ideal. But I never saw the sun again.
So were you then drafted? Or did you volunteer?
Drafted in... February, January. I went to school there in 42. We finally got some babies who were working on our 50th reunion of New Rochelle High School. We're trying to find people. I got the graduating list there. June of 42, September of 42, I went to Carnegie Tech. Then January, February of 43, I guess I got drafted. I got enlisted, but decided not to enlist. They were coming to get me anyway. You could tell right away. I went off to the Army in early 43. Went to Jefferson Barracks, St. Louis, for basic training. My group was shipped out for go overseas. I got mononucleosis and had to get left back from my class and pick up another class. Went overseas, I guess, in late 43, early 44, to Pacific. Was overseas, and some came through about who wants to go to West Point. And...
Where were you in the Pacific?
I was in Hawaii at that time. I'd come back. The unit was an aviation engineer battalion building strips. Our group built the airstrip at Macon, which was right next to Tarawa, which was the Marines landed at Macon. The Army landed at Tarawa. The Marines were at Tarawa. The Army was at Macon. And
my
we
uncle
built
was
our
there
little Marines mat and stuff like that back in 43. But they worked out of Hawaii, would come back and re-equip 804th Aviation Engineer Battalion, it was. And some came through in late 44. Anybody want to go to West Point? Applied. To make a long story short, I applied. And they picked a certain number from the Central Pacific to come back to study for the class of 45. I think there were five picked from the Central Pacific from the Army. I don't know. And came back and went to Lafayette College. It's called USMAP, U.S. Military Academy Preparatory School. It's Cornell, Lehigh, and another school, 60 each, 180, competing for, I'm trying to think how many openings, not many, from the Army. They were in the Navy, there were, of course, political appointments and things like that. So I came back and went to school at Lehigh in early 45, and in April of 45, took the tests, colorblind, but I talked my way through. I was a pretty good talk. Somehow pleaded because they instead of giving me the Ishihara test, which are the dots, I flunked. I couldn't see black on white practically. Although, you know, they fool you. They make a five look like an eight by adding some brown to green or something. But I asked for the string test, which I can pass. The basic colors I can tell, but shading I can. So anyway, I took an oath. I took an oath for 8 years in the service, and I went to the Military Academy July 2nd, 1945, with an eight-year hitch, 4 years in the Academy, 4 years at their discretion, it was either 3 or 4 years, and 4-year hitch in the Army, quote, unless earlier discharge, close quote. The atom bomb went off in August, I think. Mm-hmm. The war was over. I remember I went there in July. They kept threatening everybody. They claimed that my class of entry in 45 was the largest single starting class in the history of the academy, and the graduating class in 48 or 49 was one of the smallest in the last decades. Because everybody that had a new congressman or a senator that had some clout could get appointments or would get appointments, so their son wouldn't be able to get killed. And the academy in 44, 45, a lot of kids went there. There was a tremendous waiting line to get out. You got in line to resign. And they had hearings of why you want to resign and everything else. And then I don't think they didn't want to, you know, spend all that money on the education. So I put in the academy July, August, and I was out by September 3rd or 4th.
Oh my gosh.
Quick. The money were ahead of me. There were lots of people resigning because the war ended in August. They kept threatening they're going to redraft you, but I had so many points for months of service, so many points for overseas service, or battle stars. So September, I went back to Carnegie Tech. Of 45. Now remember, I went there in 42. I was not a good student. I went back as a sophomore. Never should have gone back as that. I should have gone back as a freshman. But little I knew, I completely forgot 3 years later. And I went back as a sophomore and I was lost. Completely lost. And I went fall of 45, spring of 46. And in those days, you had to go straight through. They accelerate everything. Three semesters are just a continuous semester. And had to go for the summer of 46. In the summer of 46, I'd added up to here. I'd had Army, and then I had college, and then I just added up to there, and I had a girlfriend also in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And I had a nice old 34 Ford, which I just bought one. I've got one, just the most magnificent 1934 Ford, fake four-door convertible.
Yes, yes.
You know, I got here a picture of a 36, which I'm going to buy, but I had the 30. I got the 34, which was the only car I ever had, and my own car in Pittsburgh. And I drive to Johnstown every night. And anyway, to make a long story short, I really flunked. The summer of 46.
This was still an engineer in your
school. Yeah, I had four R's and one D. How I ever got the D, I'll never know, because I never went to class and they felt sorry for me. I had a 0.21 factor, 0.21 in chemical engineering. 0.21. Now you figure four repeats in a D. Now school was acceleration. You couldn't fall back. The classes were full, all the veterans. And the dean of engineering, they happened to be a friend of my father's, Father Webster Newton Jones, who had been director of research or something of engineering at either Goodyear or Goodrich. Webb Jones was a hell of a nice man. Was at either Goodyear or Goodrich. And he called me in and he said, "You got to leave. You got to go." He said, "There's no place for you. You have the worst marks I ever saw in my life." And he said, "You got to go." And I said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "Well, it's your problem." He was a nice man, but tough. And then he said, "Maybe we could work a little course for you that are acceptable to transfer. And then you can transfer later on." Margaret Morris at Carnegie College, which was the girls' school of Carnegie Tech. Carnegie was all male engineering school. And he said, "I'll work some courses in government or history, economics." He said, "I won't give you sewing or cooking." But he said, "Get you a couple of courses." So I stayed after the summer of 46, fall of 46, spring of 47. I went to the Margaret Morris at Carnegie College, part of Carnegie Tech, and took liberal arts courses. I did very well. Now straight A's, you know, courses that were easy. And then I ran out of courses, so I had to transfer. I wrote to all the colleges, and the only school that wanted your last two semesters, or graded you on your last two semesters, rather than your whole college, was University of Texas. Others wanted, they look at the 0.21, so University of Texas accepted me as an out-of-state student, and I went there in the fall of 47 and graduated in the spring of 49. So that's the history of college.
And what was your major at Texas?
Business.
BBA.
Okay. Now, when you're talking, I keep talking vaguely about how long I worked for Whitco. Got to remember, I worked for Whitco in 42, full-time in Lawrenceville, Illinois. After graduating high school, came back in fall of 42, went to college, and that's counted as a leave of absence. We're a liberal company, and that was not counted. My father wanted to encourage people to come back, and therefore that was leave of absence. So leave of absence in 42, and then right from there, I went in the Army. Military leave was considered a leave of absence. I came back from the military and went back to college almost, you know, from West Point almost 3 days later. So that was still continuing education. And then I transferred and went to, again, so as far as the company records show, I started working here in 1942. I was on leave of absence from 43 to 49. But my personal records start showing in 1942. So that makes it almost 50 years here, or 49 years, but really I started working in 1949, so it's 42 years.
It's almost like that. There was no question that you were going to come back here when you finished checking.
No question. Okay. Started working right in Chicago, got married, and June, after I graduated college in June of 49, got married in June of 49, took a short honeymoon in California, and went to work in Chicago in August of 49. Now, my father was a smart man. I tell young people today, don't ever work for your father directly in the beginning. Don't do it. I've talked to him, I see people in problems, because first of all, you're pretty dumb. Your fathers are pretty smart. And to work directly for him really isn't good. So I never, never, ever worked directly for my father. People that have had problems, I think, started working with their fathers too early. So I went to Chicago in 49. I moved to Perth Amboy and the asphalt division after the explosions, and the plant was shut down for 5-6 months. Got it rebuilt and got it started in 1950. Moved to New York in 51 in chemical sales. I worked for somebody else. Then moved to Washington, beat this now, but I never worked for my father directly. Indirectly, of course, I worked for him.
Sure.
So it made it easier. That's advice I'll give young people.
How do you think the people you worked for reacted knowing who your father was?
Well, it was a small company. I just got the list here. I knew everybody by first name. In 1949, it was, of course, a lot easier. That's 1958 after we had some factories. No, I don't think there was any jealousy. That's why I mentioned before I'm going to Las Vegas and taking Jerome Harrison. He was in Chicago. He was in sales. He was so helpful, so nice. I didn't feel any resentment in the company at all. There were no great politics then. It wasn't much of a company. You know, I remember it wasn't like fighting for General Motors. You know, it was a little trading company, and anybody can be traders in those days. So one little asphalt plant down in Lawrenceville. It wasn't. Perth Amboy, I said, was built late 40s. Chicago, again, was an asphalt plant and converted to a chemical plant. And that Chicago guy was also built about 1939, just before the war. So that Chicago plant, which is a major chemical plant even today, started in 39 and is an asphalt plant. And after the war, slowly converted. We got out of asphalt and we converted more and more into chemicals.
But prior to the war, your father had already expanded to Europe, to England, wasn't it? That
yes,
the Whitco
job company, right. Harold Wilson and company with the name of it, I think it started with 42 or 49%. So together, the stuff that they developed in Europe of trading, good sources, we were alert to it, vice versa. So that it was strictly a jobbing company.
What gave him the impetus to look for a European connection?
Very simple. The major product line of the company, carried the company, was carbon black. We had these other things for paint and for ink, but rubber was a big industry. Carbon black was a major product in tire compound, besides the clay or the sulfur. Carbon black was major. In investment in the carbon black business, out of Texas, those days was gas black. You pumped out oil, and then you're familiar with just gas either flaring, and when flaring became unacceptable, they just put little metal plates over the gas and moved the plates back and forth and scraped the soot off and put the soot in bags. Not very professional, but so that was a major product.
There was no gas or oil around the whole world except USA. So the carbon black was 100% made in America, 100%. Again, I say it was a big product. As I said, we ended up in partnership with Phillips, with Continental Oil Company, built many plants here and overseas. Well, it's a long story, but we eventually bought back our own carbon black business that we sold to Continental. We had 20% sold it to them. Really got forced out, which I'll tell you, and then bought the whole thing back from DuPont. That was one of my better days, my better deals.
Okay.
It was a one-year payout. That was a good one. Anyway, so everything was exported. The whole world, wherever they built tires, they'd have American carbon black. There was no carbon black. We had distributors. We, again, out of New York, we were a distributing company. We had distributors in France, and we had distributors in Italy, and we had distributors wherever there was a tire factory, we had distributors. And my father handled that. He would go overseas once, twice a year, work with distributors. I can remember as a young business calling with him down at Clermont-Ferrand at Michelin and going to Italy, and especially, of course, the big Firestone factories all over. I still cry to this day when I'm going to Los Angeles, out of the suburbs, and drive past this unbelievably sized plant. Looks like a English fortress. It was magnificent, big. I think it's a landmark thing now. That was the Firestone plant in California. There are no tire plants in California to this day. They're all out of business. But I'm calling on some, you know, big companies overseas with him. So that's why he saw overseas potential, because the carbon black was the impetus. With the advent of oil blacks being made out of oil feedstocks rather than gas, then they used indigenous feedstocks, and you could build a carbon black plant almost any place and ship the oil. Even if it's in Indonesia, you couldn't ship the gas economically. It's interesting how one thing develops another thing. How international came because my father and because of carbon black, which put us into business overseas with a good distribution network. Harold Wilson was one of the England. We ended up buying part of it and buying all of it. And then going to manufacturing. And then the manufacturing followed the sales.
I wanted to also ask you, and you mentioned this briefly in your different address, the effect of the Depression on the economy. Let's say you were only five, but probably,
you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah. The Depression lasted a long time.
How it affected your family and how it affected the company.
I was too young to really realize, 29 or 30 or 31. 32 was 28. I'll see this later. I don't really remember the Depression. 6 days' work was normal anyway, even after the Depression. No. Fine, just everybody's worked 6 days in that day. Then it became 5.5 days, then 5, now almost 4.5. Everybody leaves pretty early on Fridays.
Yes.
The extra traffic in New York City at 3 o'clock, you get killed by the other cars.
What about the company? How did it survive during the Depression?
Theoretically, we always made a profit. Well, so we never had a year back 10 years to the war years, not the Depression. Got them in the archives, but this shows the profits of the company back in 1942 and 43 and 44. Sales were $6 million in 43. Depreciation $41,000, and taxes $70,000, income after tax $93,000 in 43. Down to $71,000 in 44, $63,000 in 45, but interesting, the depreciation schedule kept going. They're adding equipment. I could get it, but we always made money. Never went a year without it.
He was tough on that, I'll show you, tough. 1949 was a tough year. He always, I don't know how the new manager do it, I always followed his steps in that. When business was tough, he took the bosses and cut them big. 50% over a certain salary. By saying to him, we'll keep the costs on the books, and if business turns, we'll give it back to you. But if, and you can talk, it isn't so much the money, but you can talk to the people who work for you, saying, look, I've taken my cut. Talk to you now, I've taken a cut 50% over a certain amount. I've already taken mine. Things don't get better, guess who's going to be next? So you better get off your ass, and you better get tough on your people, and you better watch it, because you're the next one that's going to get it. Since I've been with the business, it's always been reinstated, always. It was back in 1949. Earnings in excess of $5,000 for the first 6 months of the year. On the date of January 5th, 1949, we made an arrangement with employees of the company earning in excess of $10,000 annually, under which the company withheld 50% of their earnings over $5,000 for the 6 months ended June 30th. The arrangement provided that these amounts would be repaid if the company earned $70,000 or better after taxes during the first 6 months. I regret, on the basis of an outside audit, when the earnings of the first 6 months were considerably less than $70,000 in accordance with the terms, amounts withheld during the 6 months ended June 30, 49 have been retained by the company will not be paid for those affected by this announcement. Period. Now, that's the bosses. Now, $10,000 is a lot of money, I guess, in those days. I started working in 1942 at 37.5 cents an hour at the former factories. Now that it's followed up again in the last 6 months, he says that we believe certain steps have taken affecting increased economies all over the company, etc. And they've reinstated the last 6 months of the year and they give it back to them. But not the first 6 months. They were tough. It was tough. You know, and, you got to remember, as a jobber, if you didn't sell, there was no profit, you didn't get paid. It was a very specific accounting system. As a jobber, your income was of course, anybody making $10,000 in those days had to be in sales. Accountants didn't make $10,000, and office people didn't make $10,000. It was the sales people. Didn't sell, you don't get any money. There's straight commission. They used to participate in 20% of the gross profit. Every invoice was costed. Carload cost, say, theoretically, 20 cents a pound. Added to that was the freight, added to that was the warehousing. The cost may have been 21 and a quarter cents a pound. If the selling price was 30, then the freight out was handled on that. Then the difference was, and the salesman got 20% of that profit. And that's what they made. We're tough. They were tough days for us, a little company. That's all.
You had most of your employees were salesmen. That would be
large. Well, they didn't come. In 49, you talking now or you talking?
Well, then.
You can count the number of salespeople we had. Sales, a lot of salespeople. It was a selling company. It was not a manufacturing company. In Lawrenceville in 1924, you had Chicago in 1939, and you had Perth Amboy in 1948. Those were simple asphalt plants. They were junk. You know, you oxidize asphalt and you spill on the ground, and that was it. There were really three asphalt plants. By 1947, Chicago was being converted to a chemical plant, but there was no, everything else was chopping, everything.
By that
part
time...
Part of my job as we grew was to get rid of the jobbing as we added manufacturing, and have a fine balance to keep all the kids, those days everybody's on commission, and have a fine balance of commission salespeople to keep them motivated. You couldn't just drop your jobbing and add a little bit of manufacturing, you had to go together. And I sold all the jobbing back to the principals. You know, where we went to all the principals, and they knew the volume, and I offered to sell them the accounts, and you know the names of the accounts and the volumes, the prices, bids. I sold back to Stout for the rubber maker sulfur business and stuff like that. So fine balance as we kept adding manufacturing. And it was slow until we went public. In 48, 58 when we went public, that's when My father asked me, he said, son, what do you think we ought to do? We can stay as we are, we can go public, or we can sell the business. What do you think we ought to do? I knew him too well. If I said Zelda Bennis, he would have fired me on the spot. We knew you couldn't say the same. So we went public, and then by being public is when we decided that we were going to use being public.
We did.
In 58, right on, we bought some mostly good companies, good people, motivated the people, had a program, a system, got rid of the jobbing, and as we added the manufacturing.
How would you compare that period when you were acquiring all these companies as to opposed what goes on in today's world of big buyouts and major changes?
First, all the companies we bought wanted to be bought. Number one, I never bought a company I didn't want to be buying. I wouldn't want to marry a girl. She didn't want to marry me. Marriage is too. I've given speeches on that. But marriage is so different. How can you marry a girl that doesn't want you? I mean, really. So there's enough of them around. There's so many. I said acquisitions are like. I said this wrong once for a girl, but I said acquisitions are like trolley cars or girls. You miss one, another one's along in 5 minutes. Was a woman lawyer in the room. Oh, I knew I said it wrong. Her face got red. But I said acquisition. There's so many around. Well, I did acquisitions. There were not many acquisitions around. There were people that did not sell. It was almost an admission of poor management. Nobody sold businesses in the 50s. Until the Raiders got more accustomed to it, then everybody sort of liked selling out. And the 80s was so easy. I mean, the 80s was mind-boggling. I'm going to show you something again. I'm going to show you. It didn't work out. Give me a copy of this one. During the war, my father sent our people to Washington to get a list of all the properties that the government expropriated from Germans. And here's all the summary of what the government took away from German companies. The dates, where they got stock, and the name of the company. They were owned by Germans. And then he checked off and he wrote letters to our people, to our legal counsel, and said, these are the ones we'd be interested in. This is when we were a little jobbing in Cherry,
yes.
And he said he wants to go to Washington, see how we can negotiate to buy the stock.
See Roman Haas on
yeah, too. But to see if we could buy the stock. The government said no. At the end of the war, they auctioned these off. When they took all that stuff away from the Germans. But he had the imagination back during the war. What's the date of that letter? During the war,
43.
He wanted to know what the government owned the chemicals, and let's go buy a chemical company from the government. They wouldn't sell it. But it's interesting.
That's fascinating. That's an interesting list.
They took everything. Italian companies here. The Roman House probably just part of the stock was probably.
I would think so, yeah.
Anyway, we didn't buy them, but the idea was good. We could have bought GAF after the war, but we didn't.
Could I have a copy of that also?
Yep.
Were most of these companies started as small, privately owned companies?
In the beginning, they were all privately owned. Then, and they weren't so small either. Sutterborn Chemical Refining was a business in 1901. White oils, petrol atom sulfonates, microcrystalline waxes. Leader in their field. The principal owner, Rudolf Sutterborn, had a stroke in 1959 and decided he wanted to sell a business through his lawyers. He couldn't really walk or talk too much, although he recovered fairly well. So in 1960, we bought that as a private company, but they wanted to be sold. It was run as a private company. Well, great company, just didn't make much money. I went down there as president. Down 23rd Street, where their headquarters were, here in New York City, on Park Avenue South. Kept my mouth shut. This is 1960. By then, I was been around a while. Now I've been working full-time since 49. Went down as president. Kept my mouth shut for 3 months. Learned the business the best I could to learn the people. Then reorganized it, put them in the Whitco system, motivation, a lot of stuff, and it's been smooth ever since. It's been one of our best biggest and best division today. That's on the board. Business, I don't want to give you exact figures, but represents almost a quarter of $1 billion, almost $250 million a year. Good business. We've added to it. We've bought a plant in Holland. We bought a plant in Trader, Pennsylvania, another one in Gretna, Louisiana, so we've added that division a lot. Our financing. We offered listed security and financing. So we bought a lot of private companies. Then our first public company we bought, first one, was 1966. They were getting rated, believe it or not, in the 90s. It was Kendall Oil. Kendall Oil Refining of Bradford, Pennsylvania. William Wyckoff Smith, Kewaunee Oil Company. Palm Beach, out of the Clear Sky Pop, made a cash tender offer. First, Kendall had a deal with Pennzoil. They put it together in a proxy statement, in our proxy statements, and then look, we had a small plan of making Pennsylvania-grade motor oil, Franklin, Pennsylvania, that came along with Sonneborn. Their brand name was Amalie, A-M-A-L-I, Amalie Oil. Franklin, Pennsylvania, 2,000 barrel a day refinery, Pennsylvania grade crude. That was 1960. In 1966, Kendall, who was much bigger, made a deal with Pennzoil to sell. And I saw the proxy and I said, boy, that's a fair deal. I said, I don't know anybody at Kendall. I don't want to screw up anybody's deal. But if somebody knew, and somebody did, Bert Fisher, who was president, I said, give him a call. Just tell him if the deal ever falls through. We're not the kind of people that want to screw up somebody else's deal, that's life's too short for that. But if for any reason the deal ever falls apart, we think it's a nice deal, give me a call. The day before closing, the Federal Trade Commission, not on Pennsylvania grade motor oil, but on the domination of crude, a small company called Minard Run Oil Company protested that Pennzoil would dominate the crude, Pennsylvania grade crude, be too big. They're an independent producer crew. They wouldn't have customers to sell to. It's crude. And make a long story short, within about a week, I got a call from Bert Fisher, who was president of Kendall. I said, Mr. Fisher, I said, I don't know you, but the deal looks like a very fair deal. We'd be happy to just substitute the name Whitco for Pennzoil, and that's it. They said, I got to see people in Wall Street. So we made a date on Thursday. And on Thursday, we talked on Friday. Saturday morning, we had breakfast together. By noon on Monday, we had two board meetings and we announced the finalized deal. The first meeting on Thursday till noon on Monday. We all held board meetings at 11 o'clock on Monday morning and we announced, because he was being rated, he had a cash tender offer after the Pennzoil deal fell through. He had a cash tender offer from Kewaunee Oil, which he didn't like, he didn't want. He liked the tax-free aspect. Anyway, by Monday we had a deal. I called the board on the telephone, had a phone board meeting. Sent copies of the Pennzoil prospectus on Sunday, and I said, just substitute the word Whitco for Pennzoil. It was a $2.35 cumulative convertible preferred stock. Kewaunee Oil upped their cash. We had another meeting. We upped from $2.35 to $2.45 cumulative convertible preferred stock. Kewaunee did it again. We did it again. To make a long story short, we ended up at a $2.65 cumulative convertible preferred. And that was it. And we had that deal. So that was the first public company. They were listed on the American Exchange. After that, there were quite a few little public companies because of the pollution problems. Hello? Hi? He's on the cover? Right now, I'll go buy it. I'll go buy it. Bye-bye. My son-in-law's on the cover of TV Guide.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's doing something with Murphy Brown.
Goodness.
That's my daughter in California. There were a lot of small, privately held, publicly held companies listed over the counter, and had great difficulty with the pollution from Pearsall, Mason Pearsall Chemical out of Houston, Texas, making aluminum chloride catalyst, just struggling, making money but struggling. Another one in Canada, public companies. They seemed so easy to buy in the middle, late 70s, small ones. They struggled with pollution just starting, with all the legal problems in the late 70s, very early 80s. Then they all got into the habit of this lovely bid process. You know, get a Wall Street firm, everybody is chasing it and put it together, and the black book, and then the bids come in. We never did that. The only one we just completed was the DeSoto deal, which was just closed in November of 1990. That came in for Wall Street Black Book bid. I've always been against it. I felt being the advantage of it. I felt somebody wants to sell something, you look each other in the eye, you negotiate, pick a fair price, and that's it. This idea of the jockeying back and forth, I'm very distasteful. I don't know other businessmen. So that's the only one we bought from a black book. And it took a long time. So long. You know, normally if you got something, I like it, you want to sell it, sit down and make a deal. So the money is really secondary, the amount of money with us. If it's a good business, and we're very giving on all the fine print and all the things that they want. There was never any problem with acquisition from the black books that were put out by Wall Street. And then everything ground to a halt. Everybody overpaid. They paid. It was sort of, we had a fool theory. The Wall Street people put the books together, said, don't worry, we'll get you the junk bonds, and you'll be able to pay for it, and don't worry, we'll spend this off for you, and we'll sell that for you, and get a big high price, and pay off the junk bond. Didn't work. I gave speeches that, when I was young, equity was good and debt was terrible. I was brought up that way. Debt is bad. Equity was good. All of a sudden in the 80s, you were nuts if you had equity, and you were nuts if you didn't really have lots of debt. And we never went for it. Just never went for the things that were brought in here that wanted to give us $1 billion, and we can, and here are the projections, and you can buy Reichhold at this price. And I said, you got to be kidding. I wouldn't pay that price. Well, and you can sell this off, and we'll get you this for that, and we'll sell. And then, you know, it's all pretty, it's so good, why don't you do it yourself? You know, that's your look up in the eye. And this excessive debt and easy debt, the ruination of a lot of companies, a lot of the economy, a lot of people have been hurt by it. We never fell in that trap. So we bought a lot of private companies first, then public companies, and then sort of ground to halt. When acquisitions, there weren't many around, we were the greatest. When everything was around, we were terrible, because I wouldn't get into this chasing process. This is where they say Surpass in Canada. Well, really, for technology, it was a great acquisition, small, but the technology was great for us. The chasing of the easy dollar, easy credit, in personal life or business life is not the best. They all thought I was nuts. I had speeches against them. Everybody was borrowing, and some came out sort of like a chain letter. You know, if you get in early or if you get out early, and musical chairs, but if you're stuck in the end of musical chairs, there's two people in one chair, you're done. I mean, that's all there is to it. You're out of the game. And it happened to a lot of people, including Donald Trump and a lot, you know, easy credit. So that's where we built our business soundly. The company itself never, from the first day of the public issue in 1958, the company never raised any money in equity after that day. Sure, we issued stock for companies that had inventories and cash. Sure, we issued paper that was convertible, but never reached the conversion price. So in effect, it was debt that had to be paid off. So we never really added equity into Lincoln, other than lots of companies we bought, but we bought them for cash, or cash and stock, or stock, which really is equity. But cash-wise, we never got the cash out of the business to help them to build it. And we really financed our business from internal cash flow. We got lots of cash flow. We've always had enough to take care of increased dividends. Very secure debt repayment. If you want to give you a schedule of our debt payment over the next 25 years, no peaks and valleys. Everything is long-term debt, no short-term debt in this company. Zero short-term debt, except you might call overdrafts in Europe, which is where they are. Okay, I'm talking too much. Ask a question.
No, that's how did you select these target companies?
We didn't select. They were available. We chased some bad ones, some good ones. We were known by getting around and associate trade associations. Everybody I talked to at CMA or the National Paint Varnish and Lacquer, the rubber company, we're a good company to join. If the time ever comes, think of us. And we became known as a nice haven for your company and your employees, and worked fast. We didn't dilly-dally. So the acquisition came in, and we reacted very quickly on it. There weren't that many around in the 50s and 60s. Everything was for sale in the 80s. Everything. Name it, nobody would turn you down. When the law became different, you almost had to talk to people that came in and said, I'd like to buy your company. I wouldn't talk to people. To this day, I wouldn't talk to the If we obviously, if we want to sell the company, I know where it would go. It'd be worth a lot more to this person than the person that came in the front door. So I would never talk to anybody.
When did you get into plastics?
Huh?
When
did you get into that?
When did we get in, or when did we get out?
We got into a company making polybutylene. Why did we get into plastic? The people running our chemical division that time thought it was a normal growth, a normal adjunct to go on making resin. A lot of us didn't feel it, but it was a terrible idea. There was an experimental company, Mobil, had a little pilot plant that they sold to the group headed by Howard Samuels. Remember Howard Samuels? We found a cordite, part of Mobil.
Oh, yeah.
Howard put together a group and bought the pilot plant of Beaumont, Texas, making polybutylene. It was meant to be a specialty resin, and a partial replacement for PVC or polyethylene in certain applications. Our people knew Howard. To make a long story short, we bought, Howard wanted some money to build a commercial plant. I took a position, we're not going to take a partnership. I got soured on partnerships almost from the day I came with the company. When you're small, they were great for us. I said we were part of the Continental Oil and Phillips. And as we grew bigger, we were big enough to make our own decisions. Partnerships are great, except you've got to treat your partner like your wife. You've got to sit down. It takes a lot of time. It's got to be financed properly. And then partnerships, sooner or later, there comes a point where the parent companies can almost do it better than the partnership. The partnership's limited. Making a product, and if there's another product to grow, each partner can do it themselves. So I never was for partnerships. Now we wanted to partner, said no, said take the whole thing. We said yes. So we took the whole thing. We bought the rights from Howard Samuels Group, I'm trying to think of the name of the company, PB Incorporated, say polybutylene, and we built the commercial plant. It was a mistake. Was a small unit, and yet the technical work, as they knew resin, we needed laboratories as big as the people that had 2 billion pounds of resin. Our whole plant was 20 million pounds of resin, yet we had film, blowing film, like 5 stories high over here in Jersey. We extruded pipe, we did everything. You had to do it. And then we had only 3 problems. Couldn't make it. If we could make it, we couldn't sell it, and if we could make it and we could sell it, we couldn't make a profit. Only 3 problems. Things have changed. Specialty product, and all of a sudden they've had to become a big body to make any money. The raw material, butene-1, was a stream really out of synthetic SBR manufacture. And with a byproduct, they're just dying to get rid of it. The shortages came, and they came back and they said, look, we want to recycle the stream back in to make some more synthetic, and the customers are dying for it, and we can't sell you the nickel a pound of this, 4 cents a pound, whatever it was, for the stream. We've got to have 25 cents a pound, which is the ultimate value of putting it into making polymers. Well, we said we can't make 20 million pounds. We can't pay 20. Well, we expanded the plant, and we still couldn't make the part. The heat exchangers kept bending, warping and bending. Then nobody really wanted to buy from us because we were the sole worldwide supplier of this product, and they were not about to develop whole new systems around one supplier, but not a dependable supplier. We'd be down for 3 months or 4 months and run for 3 months, and then the heat exchangers would bend again. So nobody really wanted to deal with it, so we raised our prices considerably. So our people were losing about $500,000 a month. We were still a fairly small company. And it was always going to be next month, always this account's going to break, always next. Finally, after about a year and a half, I said, guys, we're going out December 31st. I don't give a damn. December 31st, that unit's shutting down. Enough of this $500,000, $400,000, $600,000. I said, we're going to sell it. So we put together books and offered it out. I really belonged to the big company that was in the business and needed a little adjunct, a little 20, 30 million pounds of mouse milk to go with their billion pounds of this, you know. And it was a good product. It replaced chlorinated PVC, and it was good in hot water pipe application, actually cold water too, but hot water especially. Anyway, everybody looked at it. Nobody really rushed. It was now, I forget, don't quote me, August, September. I reported to the board almost weekly in writing where we stood. Everybody turned it down. We had a board meeting in October, and one of our directors was Michelle, had been Michelle. He said, I'm not so sure you reached the right people there. It seems logical for a fit with their program. It really is logical. The stuff that they're doing, it's like peanut nothing for them. You know, it's a little plant. It's nothing. It's almost like a pilot plant for them. He said, you reached the wrong people. Would you mind if I interjected myself at a different level? It's my boy. Anything. Within a week, I got a call. They sent 14, 15, 16 people back again to see the plant, do the economics. I was in California in November. They flew out in November. We sat down in Los Angeles and they made a deal. In an hour, it was a handshake, and that was it. We saw the plant. And it's turned out that they've expanded the plant. They know how to make resins. They know how to make heat exchangers, which we didn't. They shut the laboratory down, put it right in their laboratory. So, oh, God, what they saved that laboratory. A couple of million dollars just by not running the laboratory. Anyway, that's our experience into resins, our sole experience. Lost a lot of money, gained a lot of experience, but that's true of life.
Yes, it is. You mentioned laboratories, and I wanted to ask you about that too, because you were always, the company was always concerned about technical, say, a service and for its customers. When did the first laboratory start? When did you start doing your own laboratory application?
Well, since I've been with the company, I've always been lots of laboratories. I'm just trying to think. Of course, Lawrenceville in 1924, the first plant, had to be the first laboratory. It was a job or a broker. We didn't do technical work on making paints or making rubber products or anything like that. And Lawrenceville developed asphalts, experimented with polymer additives, experimented with catalysts and asphalt, which turned out pretty good, phosphorus, pentoxide, P2O5 added to the oxidation cycle would make what they call potting compounds, which is a senior transformer compound. So there was some laboratory work almost from the beginning. See, as a manufacturer, you have to do it. Now it's a question, do they overdo it or underdo it? I don't know today. I used to think you needed more. Today, price is getting so prevalent. You can do all the laboratory work in the world, somebody can walk off the street with a quarter of a cent a pound and you're out on your ass. Literally. Understand it. You see the monstrous loss of the Firestone, $300 million last year, of the rubber companies. They all want lots of research, development, service, but nobody wants to pay for it. So you can overdo it at times, too.
Somewhere in my file here, I have something that, well, I'll raise it and you can say whether you want to talk about it or not. But it's a report from the American Chemical Society about termination of laboratory employees. Didn't meet the ACS guidelines or something like that.
We got sued. We got a hanging judge there, Judge Soroka or something.
Oh.
He is tough. He's got us. Have you ever heard that name before?
Oh, yes.
After this was all over, I called our people in. What did we do wrong? So we'll do it again. Tell us what we did wrong. If you want to talk to our legal people, I'd be happy to raise this. What did we do? So let's now we learn from it. We swore in the Bible with outside consultant, did everything right. There's not one thing they changed on that layoff. Not one thing, but we lost the case. It's called a hanging judge, Judge Roy Bean. He's tough. So we did have a cutback in the laboratory and made that more of a sort of a research laboratory. It's now a product technical service laboratory crossing over divisions where we do, pardon me, joint sulfonation. Three or four divisions will do sulfonation, so we'll do it there instead of each division doing it. Plus the lab are dedicated now and paid for it. My Argus has most of its people out there where they're keeping downtown Brooklyn when they get mugged every night. We shut down all the research work. did everything. Argus management came up here, and the Argus technical people went to Oakland out there. So it's now sort of pure research. We were not looking for another nylon. Really, most of it was divisional, but that's where the layoff came. And we lost the case when we paid. It wasn't big, so we got bad publicity out of it. We were a bad place to work. And yet that's the way we were. Still today, if we do, we follow the same pattern of layoff. It wasn't worth appealing. The amount of money settlement wasn't worth it, really.
There's also, reading some of the more current literature, some interesting articles about speculation on your successor here at the end of the last several years.
Well, it's all in place, as you know.
Yes, no, I understand, but there were, as I looked through some of the articles, I'd see one name and then...
I wasn't prepared to retire, but after, when I was 65, they asked me to stay 3 more years. No. I said, sure. But after 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months, I decided it's a mistake. That I really want to retire. I don't know which lawsuit it was or which case or which problem, but it was just a repetition. Business used to be fun. You go out and buy some companies, work with customers, sales. God, it was fun. The last couple of years, it was no longer fun. And I tell our people here, business is no longer fun, you better quit the company. I tell them, if you're not enjoying what you do, I couldn't think of anything worse. Getting up in the morning, going to work, and saying, oh shit, another day, another dollar. You reach the point as a teacher. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was exciting, and you liked it. Right. If you retired, there was a reason.
Right.
It just was another day, another dollar, and life was dull and boring. So I decided that's what I wanted to get out of here. And I had a good successor in place by then. That's one of the reasons I wanted to get out of here, a good successor. I said to myself, I'm going to retire when I'm 99. So what am I going to do then? In a wheelchair? What the hell am I going to do with my life in a wheelchair? I'm going to retire at 99. I'm better off at 89. If I'm going to do it at 89, I'm better off at 79. I'm better off at 60. I'm better off now. And while I'm still young enough, I'm going to go enjoy things. I don't know why people stay after retirement. You went back to work, but you need the money. What's the difference? See, I can afford to retire. I'm serious. Were you bored retired? Were you bored being retired?
No, I had arranged to go continue on with, to move into this position.
You changed.
But I did take a retirement plan from the university.
Oh, you never retired. You changed jobs, didn't you? So the successor, I refused to talk about at the time because I wasn't prepared to even consider it. And things change every year or two. There's a whole new crop of young people coming up. I'm on the organization compensation committee now. They look at the aging. They say, oh God, look at the number of people going to retire in the next 5 years. I said, so what? 5 years ago, you would have said the same thing. There's always the movement upward, as long as we're promoting from within. So what? There'll be new people that aren't on the list even. There will be on the list. Hello? 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 Yes? Yes. We're in a meeting now. I'll call back.
Let me go back to your earlier career, just so I could get it straight in my mind, your move through the company. As you said earlier, you were in sales in Chicago in 49, 50 you were in New Jersey, 51 you came here to the New York office. What was your position in 51? You were in charge of sales, were you?
I don't know, so long ago. Secretary Treasurer, 1952.
Okay.
But we all did everything. The Nutton Company, 1952. Sale. Remember I mentioned the word carbon black. I'll show you how important it was. sales, jobbing, carbon black, and manufactured products. So carbon black was more important than all the rest of the jobbing. Manufactured was picking up, carbon black was level, and we're slowly cutting down a little bit on the jobbing. Carbon black was the mainstream. That was the major part of the business, that's the international part.
Well, but you come back.
Secretary of Treasury, I don't know what I did. I'm learning the business, I didn't think that's good.
Well, by 55, you were executive vice president.
Let's see if I had a title of 53. Where was around got a job? Let's put it that way. Don't laugh. You walk around. Executive Vice President and Treasurer at 56. My father was a very impatient man. We had trouble in the Chicago plant. He'd go out there every month. Be unhappy, whoever's the manager of the plate, he'd push aside and the guy would be walking along and say, you want to be plant manager? No joke. That's the way he'd had about 8 plant managers in about 12 months. He was impatient for a result. But eventually got the right guy. But we didn't lose anybody. The chief engineer, we'd go back to being chief engineer. Maintenance foreman, go back to maintenance.
Did you replace your father as chairman of the board then when he...
He retired in 19, I guess, saw his retirement there. Comes about 58, yeah.
But you didn't become president, CEO, until later on. Who was it?
Max Minnick. Yes. Was, grew up in marketing. Excellent marketing man, moved from Akron to New York, was a good outside, excellent outside man. And Max left and went to Borden Chemicals, had a Borden Chemical in Columbus, and then was shot and killed. NPRA meeting in New Orleans, shot in the streets and killed. A big thing in the industry. He and two of our people were walking down the street, took a wrong turn, went into a restaurant they were going to, ended up at a housing project. And two kids jumped down with guns on him, and he said, he was a big man, Max, lovely man. Kids, I have grandchildren over the hill, pushed him aside, went bang, hit him here. He fell down, the kid walked over and he was shot.
My God. What about the other two?
They got away. They didn't even get shot at. Ray Saunders had just retired as a woman. There was confusion of who was the boss here. Max's children, first of all of Max's children was Catholic and had 9 children. None of them stayed east. They all moved to the Midwest. And he wanted to get out of New York. None of the children stayed here. And he was offered the job by Gus Maruso, who ended up Borden. He was originally at Borden Chemical and then ended up all of Borden. And I didn't want Max to leave. But there was confusion. He was, I guess I don't know what titles were, but people came to me for decisions, including Max. But I think his title was CEO. I think he was president and CEO, and I was the chairman. I was the boss, and Max and I got along fine personally. I'll tell you the year, it was 1971, because I was racing overseas. I won the world championship.
I want to talk to you about that.
Here's where I raced. And about here, I only missed 24 days of work the whole year. I flew over on Thursday nights. I raced on Saturdays. I came back. About here, back in here, next to me, I have an envelope. See you. What is it, Max? He said, well, I'm taking a job with Borden. He said, back here. I said, I'm not going to open the envelope, Max. If I open the envelope, that's the end of my racing. I'm racing for the world championship. I'm first or second. And I said, I know my father. If you leave, I got to. Whereas he said, you got to. I said, take it back. He said, no. He said, you keep it. I said, I'm not going to open it. Okay. He said, don't open it. Nobody knows what's in there. So finally, he said, you got to open it. He said, applied for schools for my kids out in Ohio. He said, I got my house on the market. He said, rumors are out. I'm resigning from the country club. Hello. I'm in the meeting, Jeff. You call me back about an hour.
It's a match. Finally, I had to open it. That's where I quit racing.
Did not start.
I quit right here. Those two last 2 years in racing. Did not start. But then I had things worked out. He was going. But I refused to open the letter for about a good month. And that's when I took over both jobs. I had two good men. Bill Eisner ran the chemical division under Max. And Henry Sonneborn ran the petroleum part. So we still follow that format. Happy, happy. Both of them were very well off. Richard and I, both of them. We bought their businesses. Leisner was the principal at Argus, owned 60%, with a woman, Olga Nepke, owned 40%. And Henry was the nephew of Rudolph, and I guess we're up to taking care of the family. We've been dead by then. And one came to me and said, look, the so-and-so is lovely. He'd make a great president, and it's fine with me. Henry would come and say, Bill Leisner would be a great president. It's fine with me. But if he is, I got a lot of stuff that I could do. He said, I worked all my life. I got a few dollars. I'd be so. If you make him president, which I vote for as a director, I'm gonna join on it. And then Bill Leisner came and said the same thing. He said, Henry, make a great president. So same face. I took both jobs in 1971. I was besides chairman, I was president. I was chief executive officer and chief operating officer. All four jobs, which was a mistake, but I worked it out with them. They're both happy to work for me, but they both stayed. And then when Bill Leisner retired in 1976, as reaching the age of 65, Henry then took over as president. And I delegated pretty good, a reasonably good delegator. And everything worked smoothly. It was a good growth time for us. And sometimes you got to break the rules or vary the rules. Who is it says that? Wendy's or what do they have? Burger King. And sometimes you got to break or bend the rules. So it worked out. But it's a mistake. The CEO should be looking over the president's shoulder, should be the devil's advocate to operation, should expect certain results, and the president needs something to bounce off of. They're really two jobs. I had them both, which wasn't fair. As chief operating officer, I could make a decision, and the CEO wasn't looking over my shoulder. So anybody that has both jobs, I tell them it's a mistake.
How long did that continue?
5 years.
5 years.
5 years. 71 to 75 or 6. But that was one of the reasons Max left. There was still a question, who was the boss? And he would come to me for decisions. People would come directly to me for decisions. We worked nicely together. We were great friends. But he went off as head of Board Chemical, and he was happy in the Midwest.
Well, now that you raised the powerboat issue, I'd like to talk about that for a little bit. How you got into it, at least.
You get bored after I hurt my back playing golf.
You were quite a golfer.
I was a reasonably good golfer. I took a terrible shot on the third hole at Old Oaks. Hit a rock under a 2-iron. It snapped my back. They carried me off the golf course. They literally carried me. My back went down. I couldn't straighten up. It was a long tour. It was the hardest hole in the course. It was 432-yard par 4, almost all up over the green. So even with a booming drive, to get it on the green, it was going to hit into the hill and run up. You can't hit it far enough. If you hit it on the green, it's going to go over. Anyway, I had a magnificent drive. Magnificent. First time, I think, in 10 years I was using an iron instead of a wood to reach that green. And boom, there was a rock under that thing, and I'm telling you, I don't remember the year, but I wore a body brace. I couldn't tie my shoes, I couldn't put my underwear on. I had to stand up against the wall. To this day, if I sneeze, I'll hold on. So I did nothing for years, a couple of years. And my wife said, you ought to do something. You ought to get off your ass and you just sit around a weekend. We'd seen a race in Florida in Christmas time. And there was a boat show in January. My brothers, I said, made equipment for boats, built pumps and water pressure systems. Went to the boat show, and there was this little 20-foot boat. This is the boat that won the Pelican Harbor race in Miami last month. It was a famous race, the only race at that time. It was around Long Island Marathon. You know, to New York. Yeah. Went around Long Island, 243 right. miles, starting at Freeport, out to Montauk, down through the East River here, out around Rockaways, Coney Island, back to, God, that doesn't look so bad. So, make a long story short, I bought this 20-footer at the boat show. 1963, 25. It's an awful boat. I was petrified. Never had a boat. Never been in a boat. But it seemed like such fun, pushing the throttle and go. Oh, God. So it was so bad, I got nervous and chicken, and I got somebody else to drive it. They went about 12 miles, the gas tanks broke loose, and that was it. That was 1963. 1960, that was 62 for the 63 race, okay. Again, I was in Florida in 63, and a friend of this, Aronow, you guys see, you got stuff on Aronow now. Aronow at that time had started a boat company called Formula. He put in five boats for a Miami Key West race. Little boat, 23-foot boat called a Formula. And they came in, boom, boom, they were great boats. And again, at the boat show in January, there's Aronow, and he's got these little boats, 23-foot Formulas. So I bought one again to run around Long Island, much better boat than the 20-foot Allen. And I really liked that boat. I started learning boating, and got ready to race out of Freeport in the morning, going out the inlet. The engine, I burned a hole in the piston going out the inlet. Never raced in 64. So 63 and 64, I have two boats I haven't raced yet. Again, December of that year, Aronow was sold for a minute. Got to start a company called Donzi. Donzi was his nickname. Don Aronow, his secretary, called him Donzi. So he starts Donzi, which are 28 footers. And they again ran Miami to Key West, and they came in 1, 2, 3, or whatever it was. I saw him at the boat show in January of 65. He said, you want a solo? He said, anyone you want, I'll send you a boat. Take your pick. I have five of them ready to race. So I bought one ready to race in January. I went down to Florida and raced in February of 65. By a stroke of luck, I won the race. Believe me, it was a stroke of luck. This guy broke down. This guy got lost. 65, there's the boat. There's the boat. We're starting right up here. Okay, that's the boat. Notice there's no padding. There's no nothing.
Yeah,
see, yeah. You'll see as boats, it's the same boat. A couple of you look, bolsters on the back, compartments for you to go into. Look, you see compartmenting them there.
Oh, yes.
So you can't bump into each other. Anyway, that's my first race. First race I went to Danbury. Don't ask me how. And I'm a big hero. Television. Anyway, I started boat racing now. That became my hobby, and the boating wasn't the back, because boating is up and down, not twisted, not hitting a tour. And that's how I did that one. That's how I got my boating, get a hobby. And my wife didn't like me leaving for boating, so I left my wife. She said, you got to choose the boats for me. I said, I'm going to take the boats. But one race was in the Bahamas, and I would work and then go right to the airport. And I had a man that worked for me at Scarsdale would take my bags, because I didn't want to carry the bags on the train. I'd take my bags, meet me at the airport, and then I got my bags. So I'd go into the race in Florida, Bahamas, I forget which, and check my bag, went to Florida, went out, came home and I met, open it up, no clothes. All the clothes are taken out, books and newspaper. My wife was mad at me. I figured that's getting tough now. No clothes in the Bahamas, no shaving kit, no nothing. I got the message. Everybody laughed. I thought it was very funny. I didn't think it was so funny.
No, no.
So I got into boating and I raced from 64 to I won the American Championship in 70. There's where I raced in 71, the World Championship in the minute I got my last race. I'm finished and I never set foot on a boat again.
Really?
My foot's never been on a boat. That was a great boat. Aronow gave that to me as a present. Pretty good replica of it. Then he put Emily on there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's been, that's 20 years. 20 years this year I quit racing.
So what
was working? Nothing, but working ever since.
Yeah.
I dabbled a little bit in race cars.
I heard you had a drag.
Now I got a drag. I did oval track racing for a couple of years. Where's the picture? Where's the picture? Where's the, I don't know. I'm starting to pack, so I have to stuff it this one here. Anyway, I did oval track racing for 4 or 5 years. Not professional down in New Jersey, and then driving.
It's easier. It lasts only 10 seconds. What are you planning on doing next?
Well, I don't know. I've turned down two directorships. to stay active when I'm active, and I'm a trustee of outside the hospital, I'm active in this and that, I got compensation committee tomorrow. Decide to do nothing for a year, not accept anything. In February of next year, I'll decide what to do. Right now, it's a bad business. This new office is driving everybody a little nuts. I wanted the office nicer than, I don't want an office. I want it nicer than my home. I live right up the street here. I don't want to come in and do 2-3 hours work and go home and get my wife's hair, my new wife. So I want the office nicer than my home, and it is. It's a hell of a lot nicer than my home. It really is a beautiful office. We'll be moving in this week, and I'll see how that works out. I've just took a new garage where I got some cars I collect. A new 7,500 square foot garage down in Jersey. And I will say this, for a year before I retired, religiously, I took every Friday off. I wanted to see what I keep this year before. I think people are deciding that they've got to force themselves to take some time off to see if they like it. So, for a year, February of almost all of 90, I took every Friday off. And I didn't sit around. And since 90 and 91, it's now been, oh boy, 18, 17 months, I'm on two movies in the afternoon. I got a senior citizen discount here in New York. But in the beginning, I thought I'd go for 5 movies or 4 movies a week. The first 6 months, I got time to go to one movie. So I'll keep busy. I'm on the board here. I'm on the compensation committee. I'm the executive committee. I'm on the finance committee. I told you earlier in this conversation, I think we're going to go for money now. I'm goosing the new chairman. I'm on the committee. I said, I just think we don't want to miss a window of opportunity. It's just the rates are low and stock prices are high. We can choose which way to go.
How many companies do you think you were personally involved in acquiring during your tenure with the company?
Everyone except Sonneborn. My father, which was the biggest, probably the best. I give him credit for that in the first. Remember, we didn't go public till 58, and he was still active till then. I said overseas, he did almost all the negotiation, picking the company.
Hello? Hold on a second, I'll turn here. This? Well, Dorothy, this is for you. Sonneborn was his. He knew Rudolph, the man that had a stroke from a social club here, and handled that one almost all the way. After that, they started coming by 58. That was the Sonneborn 60. Then the International kept him busy. Otherwise, every one of them reported directly. I mean, the acquisition, one man on acquisition reported directly to me. That I handled the negotiations, and people feel comfortable with me. I mean, really feel comfortable because I'm really a very decent, honest man. Money is secondary. Literally is. And reputation is important in our industry, and motivation of people. I found a policy of promotion from within, where it's a good company to work for. If you work here, you're going to get promoted if you're any good. And I say, before the top people are all going to be out, there'll be a whole new echelon of people. Great opportunity.
Given me with a Whitco story, but I've lived up to it also. And I've leaned over backwards to promote people from the acquisitions, and some of our own people, the old Whitco people, accused me of not being nice to them. But there are no more old Whitco people, because the Sonneborn people from 1960 are the old Whitco people now. And Argus and Kendall from 1966 are the old Whitco people. But you look around, the chairman came from the Carbon Black Purchase, Connell Carbon Company, which I bought 7-8 years ago. He's the chairman. Dennis Andruzzi was a Sonneborn man. Bill Mahoney was the other one. The chemical man came. We bought Humco in Memphis and moved him up here. So they came from acquisitions.
You just mentioned something you were going to come back to that from earlier. You're getting back into Carbon Black after all the time you were out.
Carbon Black built our company. I showed you figures before. It was made all in America. We did a hell of a job of manufacturing here through associations of investment with Continental Oil Company and Phillips.
investments also with individual from Canada. You could build a carbon black plant any place. Just go with this little gas coming out of the ground, put up some sheds. Have you ever seen one? The soot comes up and goes over 50 miles. You can see it 50 miles away. Unbelievable. This pure black soot. Nobody collected anything. Gas, carbon black sold as low as 2.5 cents a pound. That was worthless. They couldn't afford to put up equipment to collect. Whatever you collected from the scrapers, they fell down and threw it in bags. Oil changed everything. It became sophisticated, but it was worldwide, but it's very important to us. We had five different companies. Crown Carbon Company was a partnership with a very large ink manufacturer from Canada. We had Panhandle Carbon, we had Whitco Carbon, we had, I say Crown, we had Continental, we had one more, Bornhardt Hydrocarbon also. So, and we ran them all. We meaning my father. My father was president of the carbon black companies. Whitco handled the sales of these five companies, and we allocated the sales based on their share of production. This company had 12% of the manufacturing or production that month. They got 12% of our orders. That's all there was to it. We kept separate books, subject to audit. If any of the partners could come in and look at the books, we treated everybody fairly. We took a selling commission, and we owned parts of the companies. Over the years, with the change of oil, they were merged together. The gas black plants slowly phased out, called channel black versus oil black. And the dominant one became, these were archives for publication. I don't, I'm not ashamed of what I'm going to say. They know how I felt. We ended up with the mergers of putting everything together of the overall company, 20.16% of the stock, 20.16%. The other partner was Shamrock, Shamrock Oil out of Amarillo, and Continental Oil out of Houston. And we have joint board. We are very nice. All the top people, Continental Oil Company use us as a training ground. Some of their top people over the years, and sitting on the board with all the top people. Mr. McCollum sat on the board, and Howard Blauvel sat on the board, and Tarkington. You name the top Continental Oil, they like this Continental Carbon Company. We have 6, 7, 8 board meetings a year. We report on sales. Shamrock wanted out and sold their stock to Continental. Continental owned 50-some percent. We owned 20.16, and Shamrock owned 28-point-something percent. So they bought them out. We had the right of first refusal. We turned it down. But they came to me and they said, look, you got 20.16%. Will you sell us the 0.16? That way we'll have 80%. If we have 80%, we can consolidate for tax purposes. We can save a lot of money. We'll still run it separately. But instead of owning 20.16, you'll own 20. We're going to save a lot of money on tax. I could have said, well, that 1.6% is really important to figure out how much taxes and charge them accordingly. I didn't. I said, okay, if it helps you, your partners. Whatever you're paying Shamrock for their 28, we'll take the same, you know, prorated price for our 0.16%. It wasn't much money. So now they own 80%. They consolidate for tax purposes. Okay. Now, over the years, a couple of years go by, and they decide, rightfully so, that they'd like to do their own manufacturing, or their own marketing themselves. We had an evergreen with a 36-month cancellation, and we thought we should handle the marketing. And we're better positioned to do it. We have the organization of marketing for 30 or 40 years, have a lot of entree, and we renegotiated the selling commission. I forget it was from 10 to 8%, whatever it was downward. And again, we held them off. But finally, one day, on December 31st at 5 o'clock, I'm working here, I get a registered letter giving us, this after 40 years of business together, a registered letter terminating the marketing agreement. Not even a phone call. The partners. So they were terminated from the marketing. We had 36 months evergreen. And we still own 20%. We still own 20% of the stock. It's a great story. So it's like a novel of who did it. I was a little offended. I said, you know, we're board members, friends together. You could have told them, could have maybe negotiated something. Well, they want to do it themselves. I fear this is the way to cut the cord. Yo.
Excuse me, I'm going back over to the building.
Okay.
This time they tell me they changed the locks.
Okay, bring back a new key?
Hope so.
You want to get that, Dorothy? Okay, we got 36 months. I we go along for about 6 months. I hire somebody. I'm really bad now. I want to go to Carbon Black Business. I hire a guy, Charlie Blocky, to come to work for us. He just retired from Colombian Carbon. And Charlie said to me, what's going to happen if my recommendation is not to build a carbon black plant? I said, don't worry, we'll find something for you. Don't worry. Sure enough, his recommendation, he couldn't get know-how, don't do it. He ended up in charge of investor relations, advertising, finally got into marketing and where he belonged. Nice man, Charlie Block. So a year goes by, a year and a half, and it's getting tough because we're sort of lame duckish. They're hiring people, but they can't put them out in the field because we have exclusive and we're still 20% owners. The costs are going up. So I go and I make a deal with myself, the marketing organization. The people have choice to go with them if they want to or stay with us. And they go direct marketing about a year and a half. Now business gets a little tough. They cut out dividends. They got 80% of the company. There's no dividends, so they're friends. We've been in business a lot. They go and I say, look, guys, we're not doing the marketing. What the hell? We got 20% investment in this little private company that doesn't pay dividends. We got no return on our investment. We go to board meetings. We just sit around. We're not involved in the operations. It's just an ownership. Buy us out. Buy our stock. Well, they laughed at me. It's why we buy out. We consolidate for tax purposes, no payout on buying out. We're consolidating for all purposes. We're not paying dividends. Why should we pay you money? It's not costing us anything to keep you in. I said, you son of a bitches. Now I don't ever get mad. I said, I really freaked out. I said, the only reason you got consolidation because I gave you a 0.16 and now you're shoving up me and telling me I really got mad. My whole business life I never got mad. And these are people I'm still friends with. I consider them highly unethical, highly screw with me. It would have been nice to say we'll take you out and you know what the hell, you're not involved with the marketing, you're not involved with anything. We still went to board meetings. I wouldn't pay directors fee. I still went to board meeting because I was trying to, now they want to. They're at Ponca City, Oklahoma, where we have a plant. They want to shut down the carbon black plant in Ponca City and use the bubble concept for pollution where they're expanding their refinery. If they eliminate this much pollution in the carbon black plant, they can save, and I won't give you figures, but I heard some unbelievable figures how much money they could save on building the expansion of the refinery because they wouldn't have to put in the pollution stuff, so good aboard me. They're going to shut down the carbon black plant and they're going to pay the company book value. And look at them. I said, you guys got to be crazy. Book value. You're going to pay replacement value of that plant. If you don't tell me you're going to use depreciated value, you don't know what a stockholder, you're going to get sued right and left and right and left and right and left. I was really upset. They're not going to, now they're going to steal the plant and do book value, which is now depreciated almost to nothing. So I threatened a lawsuit. Never did before. These are good friends and still friends with John Kirsch and other people. Make a long story short, they agreed to take us out, finally. The only reason they took us out is because of the forcing amount so they could use the bubble cuts. They took us out. And they paid us the price for our 20%. I was happy with that. Now, over the years, a few more years go by, and Continental is bought by DuPont. DuPont decides that I want to be in the carbon black business. They negotiate. In my own mind, I want to get 100% of that company for what they paid me for the 20%. In my own mind. I got it. I negotiated the thing and I took the money they gave us for 20% and got 100% of the company. By then they straightened out some of their international operations and sold them to Philips International. They bled the companies. There was no money. They took big dividends out and there was no money left when they had a bad year. So they were heavy in debt with some guarantees. They worked their way out of international. I just got 3 domestic plants and their joint venture with Copper's Australia for the price that they paid us for 20%. It's been a nice venture in a sense. Anyway, end of story. I was just upset when they laughed about buying the 20%. There was no business reason to buy the 20%. There was no tax saving. There was no cash outflow on dividends. Why would they give us money and get nothing in return for it? I really got upset because these are the same people that asked me would I kindly sell them 0.16%. I said, sure. Anyway, that's it. Okay. So we're in the carbon black business again.
About phthalic anhydrides, I
think. Oh, that's again our failures. Phthalic, wrong process, wrong size plant. We came at the end of the cycle of naphthalene versus orthoxylene, fixed bed versus fluid bed. Just at the time that they were just about getting ready to switch over to ortho and
fluid bed, we were building the last of the fixed bed naphthalene plants. We were just not competitive. We had 20 million pounds in Chicago, 30 million pounds in Perth Amboy. Shut them down.
Called the junkie, pulled them off.
Mm.
Commodity. What about special? It's a commodity chemical.
We're still trying to stick to specialties. That's our company.
How was your father, how shall I phrase it? How was it having your father look over your shoulder for all those years?
Great. We remained good friends. I never worked for him. He pushed me. He pushed me ahead. He did. And he was very supportive of everything I ever did. Very supportive. I could tell the story again for history. The Kalani Kendall Oil, 2035 cumulative convertible preferred, 245, 255, 265. It was getting a little rich at the end. Seemed rich in those days anyway. In 1966, the amount that we were giving, which is a guaranteed cumulative convertible preferred stock, so we had to give the 265 instead of the 235, which is 30 cents a year on the number of shares, dividend. So it was getting rich at the end. We had another board meeting. Should we up it one more time? I felt negative vibrations from the board. I really, the figures showed it. So I said, I'm not taking a vote today. Let's think about it overnight. But let me just say, unofficially, if I were going to have a vote right now, how do you think you'd vote? I went around the table, so my father was sitting at the right. And everybody expressed them, and I just had to figure out that's why they called for a vote. And it just came, I could see if there was a vote, I'm going to lose him. It came to my father last minute. He said, stop pussyfooting around. What kind of wimps are you? Let's go for it. And everybody said, I agree. And it was 100%. I said, let's take a vote, 100%. He didn't, it's only money, he took that position. He wanted them to just go for it. What the hell? And everybody quickly switched.
That's a beautiful story.
Well, they respected his opinion. They really did. They were good people and outside directors, but very thorough. But when it came to our business, they respected it. And I say the same. I've had 100% backing from the board every single day. I never had anything. Yeah, once. Want a quick story again for the history?
Sure.
We do everything by the numbers, approvals, and board meetings, and everything else. And we were buying a new piece of equipment, an earth mover. We do diatomaceous earth, where we strip this out of the state of Washington. We take off the top 10 feet, we dig up the stuff, we calcine it, blend it. That's a filter aid. Buying a new piece of equipment. People that time had International Harvester, big companies. They wanted a Japanese piece of equipment, Kubota. And there was a certain time they presented very well. They had written statements from the users of the Kubota equipment. They had letters from the state about Kubota's inventorying of spare parts. They had maintenance records and was better than the International Harvester. This was $700,000-$800,000 piece of equipment. And time, there was a price on it with a time that fell in before our board meeting. So I said, place the order, what the hell. Came to the board meeting, and there's a routine thing, just replacing an earth mover, well documented on the parts and the service, and the price was 12% cheaper, and a lot of stuff that was just so great. Came to a vote, my brother spoke up. He said he thinks it's un-American for us to buy foreign equipment, American workmen need this and that, and 12% or 14% that much, it can't be that bad, and we should go American. The board said, yeah, you should go. And I said, board, I hate to say, we already purchased it. First time I said, I ever violated anything, and you caught me with my pants down. I said, I've never violated anything. And the first time you get caught, it's like a guy cheats on his wife. The first time, in the movies, they get caught. The first time. What was that, the movie with the first time? So everybody laughed and went home. Then I realized, the next board meeting, my brother has never had anything but foreign cars his whole life. I've never had anything but American. He has bought nothing. He hasn't had an American car in 25 years. Then I called him. I said, never, you son of a bitch, talk about buying American. What are you doing? Oh, that's my personal life. That's not business. You should buy. I'm glad he bought the Kubota. He's always had foreign cars. He loves cars. He buys three or four a year and sells them off to his friends. Never American.
He's got now today. He's got a Volvo. He's got a Mercedes, and he's got that new 850 BMW, the new 12-cylinder BMW. Okay. So that was phallic. What was wrong with phallic? We went out of phallic. It turned out to be a commodity, not a special run here for that.
There's an expression which shows up a number of places, including your Newcomen address. Dates back to your father's father, your grandfather. Well, there's something wrong with that.
I just took it down off the wall. So the only picture I had here was a quotation of our ad agents. The next day, rushed it over to us and said, there's something wrong with that horse, Eli Wishnick. And above it was a little painting. Oh, there's the car I'm talking about. The oval track car. I do have a picture someplace. That's a hand-built oval track car. And somebody, there's a little picture above, a little guy in a horse and wagon down the, in the road pedaling. Little Jeepy nothing. The picture, I was in Chicago, and the lawyer who was originally a board member, because our firm started in Chicago, was the law firm, called Leroy Weiss. And I was in Chicago, and his whole room is filled with diplomas and this and that. And there's one little picture of a little horse and buggy, very badly painted. I said, Roy, what's that do? He said, that reminds me of your father. He said, would you like it? I said, yeah. He said, would you hang it? I said, yeah. He said, I'll make you a deal. You send me a picture of your father. I'll give you the picture here. It's been sitting here. It's been sitting here. The picture, and this is the thing, this is there's something wrong with that horse. They took it in last week to reframe it.
They put over to the other place.
Yeah. The agency said, oh, there's something wrong with that horse. And as I said, they're in business. Sometimes you got to be the devil's advocate. What, you know, what if? There's something wrong with that deal.
So your father sort of acted as the...
Yeah, he was a good devil's advocate, but he was very supportive of me, everything I did. And we discussed a lot of stuff. The last 10 years of his life were tough, maybe 5 years. About 5 years. I used to wheel him in every day. He lived up here at a park in 56th. Pick him up in a car. In the good weather, I'd wheel him here. Pick him up in a car. At the other building, we had to come in through the service elevator. No ramps and take. He read his Wall Street Journal. He had Parkinson's that affected his throat. He didn't shake, but he couldn't talk. Besides being fragile and frail, he could not talk, but he understood everything.
My mother just went through that.
The throat also?
So I understand that.
Yeah. We lived a fine life. He died a couple months short of 88, and he kept working right till then. Doctor told me he's going to die. He lived up here at 56 at the Lombardi Hotel. But the doctor, his personal doctor, happened to be the house doctor also. He was in the hotel every day, every morning from 8 to 12. Then went to the hospital with his patients. So when I'd see him at lunch, I'd bring lunch up like this, corned beef sandwich, so the doctor would come up, see my father, and then go to work, go to the hospital. Tell me one day, so your father was going to live 3 days. What do you mean? No different than he was last week. He said his will is gone. There's a difference. When you want to live, you live. But he said he's decided it's time to go. His will is going. He just moved. And that was it. 2 days he was gone. That night. So he's right. He says, if you want it, you're going to fight. So I like old people who are grouchy and angry and to fight back. When they don't fight, they're in trouble. Right?
Right. Yeah, my father's 86, so.
If he's grouchy and yells in, that's good.
Exactly. How do you compare the new people coming into the company today? Say your company in particular, the industry in general, over the years that you've been involved?
Not as productive. More staff, which is very important, by the way. It may be important, but it's not as productive. It's important because you've got to comply. People fill out. I had a policy here. Hope they're following. We don't fill out any voluntary anything. If you got to do it, we're going to do it. It's voluntary. When Congress writes in, please describe all of your processes. Tell us the type of equipment. Tell us this and that. Voluntary. Now, if they want it, if we got to do it, we're going to do it. We can't have engineer. So the staff, they're good people, but they're not productive. They're very non-productive, but important, essential, and you can't survive without them. You can't survive without them. The day's work doesn't produce, and that's why I tease people about everybody's meeting. Nobody's going out and getting orders. I mean, what the hell's happening? Nobody's, theoretically, we used to be, maybe 50% of our people were marketing people. Now, if it's 5%, I'm a lot.
Really?
Yeah, if we've got 8,000 people, if we've got 400 in direct marketing, that's about right. you know, 20 in this division, 50 in this division, 30. I don't even think that much. I can show you this list here. Everybody I can check off who's in sales, at least 50% were in sales. Today, I don't want to go 5%, it'll be 400 direct, so maybe it's 500 direct work. I don't know. That's what you consider direct marketing, inside the office taking orders. The more salesmen, the better. So it's frustrating, and I think it's one of the reasons why it was no more fun.
Did you do much selling yourself?
Oh, I was a great salesman. I was one of the best. I thought. Every salesman thinks, oh, sure. We're a small company in the 50s. We had nothing. We had a chemical plant everybody sold. We had no staff. There was no environmental staff. There was no legal staff. We had an insurance manager, I guess, at work. That was it. Factory insurance. Not much. The insurance department got 11 people. They go overseas to review insurance. And everybody's traveling. But getting orders is it. I think that's what we built them. It's my heart cell. I will say this, that the combination of, I've said this again, the combination of the three companies. Whitco was heavy in marketing. And we didn't give a damn about research. We didn't give a damn about manufacturing, marketing, ran this company. Then we bought Argus, and we bought Sonneborn. And Sonneborn didn't give a damn about marketing. We're like, wash the floor and then go out and sell. Technical was not very heavy, but manufacturing, these are monstrous plants. Make their own sulfuric acid and really big, heavy industrial plants. So manufacturing ran Sonneborn and marketing ran Whitco. And then Argus, the technical people ran it. Marketing and manufacturing, you have patents, technical. And the three legs of the stool of manufacturing, marketing, and research. Really, starting in 66, really seemed to gel back to our bottom line. We all infrastructured with each other. The Leisner ran Argus, moved up here, ran all the chemicals, and Sonneborn, moved up here and ran all of the petroleum parts of the business. So it worked pretty well. But I don't think people today, they're awful good, they're awful bright, but not as productive towards the bottom line, but essential. That's all I can say, not productive, but essential. If they all disappeared and we didn't have to do what we had to do, business would be a lot better. And we're very pro-environment, we're very proactive, we're very conscious of what we do today, but there's such a thing as overkill, too. It's just overkill. We used to measure stuff in parts per million. Now it's parts per billion.
Right.
Now they got equipment to be parts per trillion. Well, I mean, come on. Parts per million's out there, and everything is mostly everything parts per trillion. People didn't die when they had 10 parts or 1 part per billion, so, I mean, per million, and when you add 3 zeros, it's
yes, I
you hear that same thing as you go around.
Yes, absolutely. Over the years, did you have any major accounts, or was your business spread out over a lot of smaller accounts? Or were they?
In the beginning, rubber was the thing. Mm-hmm. When you saw those figures there, there were only 5 rubber companies, really. Firestone, Goodyear, Goodrich, General, and I'm trying to think of the Goodyear and Unirail. That was it. I'm going way back. There were 5 accounts, and we all personally went into Akron. We personally covered everybody at Akron from top to bottom, from the receiving clerk to the technical manager. And of course, we did a lot of business with the Armstrongs and the Coopers and the Generals, but the major tire companies. Now it's diverse. Today, if you take the total company, there isn't that dominance. By division, there is. Some of our divisions that do 50 million of sales, they'll have a dominant customer that'll do 5 million, 10% of their business. But on a total basis, no.
What about competition?
All over the place. Unbelievable.
All going years back, too? Or were you, in the rubber industry, were you pretty much?
We always compete with Cabot, who's very good. You know, Cabot, European. They don't make much money. We think prices are too low. We don't collude. We don't talk about prices. We just know they're not making the money they should be making. And we're not making the money they should be making. Having been a new producer, tire people are killing each other, and therefore go to the raw material people and say, you got to support us or else we won't talk to you for 20 years, you know, and stuff like that. So everybody earns. I guess Detroit goes to the tire people and say, we're earning. damn it, this long you'll pay for tires, and I'm not going to talk to you for 20 years. Public goes to buy a car, they look at the sticker, and they go down and they chisel the last guy the last $100, that's all. But things are, everything is different today. Now, there's no one industry anymore. Plastics are very big with us. Plastics crosses most of our divisional lines. We have products, a lot of products from organics that go to plastics. We call Argus, very heavy. Humco, very heavy. Sonneborn, very heavy. The white oils are lubricants and stuff. So plastic probably is our biggest single industry today. But it's diverse amongst lots of accounts.
So you say as you're moving it down the street here, or up the street, I should say, that...
Park Avenue. 53rd Park. This is 53rd Madison, according to you can almost see the building.
So you feel confident in the future of the company?
Oh, yeah. I think it's very well managed. I think they got their eyes set on better margins. I just hope the morale... It's different. You can't stop things. I was very easygoing. Morale was very important. Our people were very important. I think it helped us in acquiring companies. Our reputation of treatment of people did certain things 3 years ago. I don't want to toot our own horn. I look at our pension funds. We're doing so goddamn well. And I was heading the pension committee. I said, let's take a look at giving some money from the pension to the retired people. Let's take a look. Well, the problems you had to go to, you had approval with the government for signatures and registered. Make a long story short, everybody that's was retired at that time got $500 cash, plus $100 a year for every year they're retired. Somebody retired 15 years, we get $500, 1500, we get $2,000. Voluntary out of the pension fund for the older folks. Well, I explained to the board, I think that's good for morale for them, but it also affects the people that are working for the company. There's so damn much money that we're overfunded, and what are we sitting on for? It doesn't do anything for Whitco. Still doing well, I'm bringing it up again, let's do it again. It was 3 years ago. I got the nicest letters from people a lot of them felt it wasn't the money, but they remembered the contribution. We had one guy who was 99 years old. He's still alive now. He's 102. So he was retired, I don't know, 48 years or 49 years, so he got $5,400. He mows his lawn. He bought himself a lawnmower, sit on. Got lovely letters from people. But it's morale. So I worry, but at the same time, I think, you know, it's a different environment than I was young to. And this was built on personal relationships. They were lasting, long-lasting. Today, people don't think anything whack. 800 people gone, just like that. I don't know how those 800 people were doing the day before. We haven't had any layoff. That's the only layoff we've had. We haven't had any early retirement programs. I'd rather freeze hiring than fire. We have a lot of retirements every month. Every month people are retiring. And why fire and then hire for replacements? Why not just freeze? Take care of yourself, 100, 150, 180 a year retirements, that's all. A lot of people gone, just switch them around.
I mean, again, I'm not all. Though that does not seem the norm. I mean, you hear most places they can't wait to get early retirement.
We ran thin. We were never, I thought, heavy. I sort of watched it because I didn't want it to go. As I said before, we all did two or three jobs. We really always did. Now we're getting more professional. They poo-poo me when I say Whitco's a lot of small companies the way we run them. It's not a big company. It's not a billion cents. It's
50 minutes. A little $50 million company there. It's a $40 million company. $150 million company. They run their companies. There's a corporate vice president who runs those. He runs the manufacturing, the marketing, the research, the tech service, everything. All we do here at Witco is handle accounting and credit and human resources, and what I call some of that legal. And we leave these guys alone to run their business. They run their business. If they got a lawsuit, send it in New York. We take care of it. Credits, they don't even worry about credits or collections. So it's a simplified line organization operation. So there's a lot of little businesses. And therefore, you can't build a big infrastructure. Central engineering does the engineering. We don't have engineering capabilities in every one of our divisions. We have small engineering capabilities in the big divisions. But we have central engineering that go out on a job, they live on a job, they'll turnkey a job and hand it back to them. What a great way to run a business. I want a new sulfonate plant. Okay. Witco provides the financing. We do everything, and 24 months later, here's the key. There's a nice new plan for you, manager. Simple way. While you're busy, we hope getting orders. Mm-hmm. So it's the way we've run it. Now, whether you can run it that way today, I don't know. Anyway, I'm retired. I like that.
Company loyalty.
Tremendous.
I would assume so from what you said.
Promotion from within, turnover is negligible. That may be bad. May be bad. Very seldom do we go out for outside. Certain jobs, we almost have to go outside. We don't have the in-house expertise. But we start off with our engineering. Our central engineering people are great. They go out on the job. They live in a little shack for 6 months. They construct a job. They're process engineers or chemical engineers, with a process background. The movement from within has been nice. So Bill Mahoney came up from Memphis not too long ago. Bill Toler came up from Houston not too long ago. I've been successful in talking to people in New York. They say New York is not, people don't want to come here. I don't believe that. Nobody lives in New York. They like to come to New York. Well, they all live 20, 30 miles out of New York. That's why the kids go to school out there. And New York's exciting. New York's got everything, I think. I think of living in Houston. And eventually, I guess they'll move. They want to get a fish and they'll move, so it's up to them. When I was here, we weren't going to move out of New York. Awful out there. You live where?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Well, that's at least a cosmopolitan city. But I don't think you want to live in Dubuque, Iowa.
No. No, I spent 2 years in New York in the 50s, and it was great. I lived in Greenwich.
That's because you're a single.
True.
It's always single. Well, it's always great when you're single. On the record, he's laughing, but he says, that's true.
It is.
Well, we have good loyalty, very low turnover. We don't get much out from the outside. That's why being in the boondocks wouldn't be good. At least in the city, there's an excitement. There's all these meetings that you can go to. God, when I was young, there was something going on in New York every single night, every day, in between traveling.
So a lot of the industry organizations were headquartered here. Your other businesses were located, headquarters were here. You could probably meet people much more easily here in New York.
We used to have the Chemist Club. The Rubber Group was here, the Paint, Varnish, and Lacquer Association, the plastic section of the MP, of the CMA. A lot of things were going on. Now, of course, a lot of companies moved out of here. Things have changed. It's still the center of insurance and banking and export documentation. I don't know. I find it exciting because I'm a New Yorker. I live in New York. It was a commute. Don't find it so exciting. Well, they all think if we move to the country, it's going to be right next door to them. They forget. If we go to Jersey, the Connecticut people got another half hour to go, or vice versa. You know, everybody thinks the ideal thing to have the office done, like I am. The office down the street. I live on 56 and the office here on 54. That's ideal. So I tell them, and they're making enough money, by the way. Salaries, I think, are just tremendous. They're making enough to move to New York. They really are. I'm talking the top people. I have no business in the world commuting an hour and a half each way each day. No business in the world. They're nuts. They can talk all they want about costs. If they keep fair costs in the second car, because they have a company car, and shoveling the snow, and commuting, and painting their house, or painting the interior every 4 or 5 years, and all the work that's done out there versus coming to the city, especially after their kids have grown up, and renting an apartment, they're nuts to live in the city.
and go home at 6 or 6:30 or call your wife, let's go to a movie, let's go to a theater tonight, let's go to the art museum, let's this. Everything is here. They get on the train, they go home, they get home at 8 o'clock like I used to, and there's nothing there. They eat dinner and they go to sleep. They're nuts. Because that's my speech to them. Try it. Come to New York. I got a couple of moving already. Two big ones moved in the last year. And both of them love it.
Is that attitude changing? I mean, Greenwich, Stanford, that area, all the corporate headquarters are out there.
Commuting is bad. You ought to see the bumper-to-bumper traffic there in the afternoons. If I go up there on a call, at 4:30, the Hudson River Parkway is bumper-to-bumper. Everybody's out there. Who was it just recently, as big art in the New York Times, 16 years ago they moved there, and now they're moving to Atlanta for the same reason they said they moved out of New York. You know, schools, taxes, transportation, traffic, everything else. New York has no traffic. Don't even need, I don't have a car. I walked to work.
Yeah, you didn't need one.
Don't need one. Right. I was the only one in the company. I was entitled a company car. Over a certain position. The last 7 years, I refused to take a company car. I don't want it. I don't want a company car. I walk.
Well, right now, I'm doing that in Philadelphia, and it's great. Really, it's the first time I've been able to do it in my life, and it's great to walk around the corner and go to work.
Put up his nice that old section down there.
Rittenhouse Square.
Rittenhouse Square. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, is there anything you'd like to mention that I haven't asked?
I see you've got a pretty good archive there.
What?
I see that. Where do you get that? So you push the computer and out it comes? Or do you get
stuff my research assistant.
I mean, where do they get this from? Do you have a service that does it?
No, she just goes to the computer. And
so that's old. That's really old. I got that right here in my book.
This is 1966.
Now, where did you get that from?
New York Times? New York Times.
I've
microfilm.
I've got this in my box right there. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's Max.
Right.
Max Minnick. Back in 69.
Oh, and that's the...
He got murdered, by the way.
Yes, you told me
he got murdered.
And that's...
Oh, he got murdered.
Oh, he did.
Oh, big.
Really?
A new book out on him. Just
really?
Called Blue Thunder. He and George Bush were great personal friends, and the CIA and the Mafia. I don't know, it's all bullshit. Still, they arrested somebody. He got shot six... Right in front of his factory. Bang, 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 bang. He found a couple of years ago.
Oh, my gosh. Blue Thunder, is that
it? Blue Thunder's the name of the book just came out.
Oh,
he was building a boat called the Blue Thunder for the Coast Guard. George Bush fell in love with it. It's a silly book, but it's... It won't get a Pulitzer Prize out of it. Is there anything else to say? I find business very simplistic if you follow certain lines. That, again, you can't vary, you can't be... This would go to the left one day, go straight the next day. There's a certain way you got to run your life, personal life, and your business. I tell young people, you can't shade it this way one day and then decide you're going to. You got to earn a reputation. People, it takes a lot of years to earn a reputation. When overnight it can go, just gone. Once it's gone forever. So we try to get our people to certainly be very law-abiding. We don't collude on prices. When it comes to ecology, God damn. Some even an unreasonable. We lean over backwards. Sure, we're paying for the sins of things that we did 20 years ago. What we did 20 years ago was legal. It still seems to me illegal, immoral, or unconstitutional to pass new laws retroactive. It's got to be unconstitutional. But the government, and the government is the worst polluter, by the way, of anybody in the world. These arsenals. I get out of some of these arsenals. I can't believe what they've dumped over the last 30, 40 years at Edgewood Arsenal, a place like that. I mean, this is unbelievable. But what was done 25 years ago, everybody, you did it. There was nothing illegal about doing it. Now they say, by the way, what you did, we just passed a law. That was illegal, what you did, and therefore we're going to penalize you for it. Criminally, RICO, triple damage, whatever it is to threaten you to... I don't quite understand to this day. Our people tell us it's been upheld in the Supreme Court, but the passing of laws I can understand, the retroactivity of them, I still can't understand. Where the government wouldn't say, hey, we changed the rules now, we're going to... You got to be responsible from here on forward. From here on backward, we'll take care of it. But to say you, or the deep pockets theory, you are the only one that's left around town that's got any money, therefore you're in trouble. You put 10 drums in this 1,000 drums, you're fully responsible. The law's upheld that, by the way. 10 of your drums are in this 1,000 drum pile, but
For 990 drums, those people are out of business, so therefore you got to clean it up or triple damage, or we'll do it and charge you. Anyway, the problems of business today are not as productive. I think company-wise, we're now ahead of Europe. I think Europe is paying the penalty for what we've been paying the last 10 years. Especially Eastern Bloc Europe is unbelievably polluted, inefficient, broken down. Western Europe is polluted, but efficient. Building a business is pretty easy. You know, make a product, price it fairly, you go out and sell it fairly. Doesn't seem hard. I think today, financing your business is entirely different. We've done it our way. We've done it long range, well spread. Let me see if I got our spreadsheet here. It's amazing how throwing stuff out, getting ready to move. Here's a spreadsheet of all of our debt, total corporate debt, showing the spreadsheet here all the different debts of the company and how much is due through the year 2012, with only one peak here, which is this industrial revenue bond. But otherwise, this was the 5.5% we just borrowed, $150 million, all spread seven all over every year. So there's been no drain on the company's earnings to pay the debt. And I feel sorry for people today that are building a business and work all day and all week, and Friday night at midnight they put all the money in a wheelbarrow and they run it down to the bank and say, here's our interest. There's nothing left to build a business. They're nuts. They've got to be crazy to have financed a business with nothing left to build it. How could they do that? They destroyed businesses. Hello? Yeah. In the meeting till I'm calling back.
Do you think after the experience of the 80s that attitude's changing a little bit?
No, the reason they can't get it. They'd be happy to take it. Somebody walked in the morning and said, Donald Trump will give you $1 billion. They'll take it. You know, he's took it. They just won't give it to him anymore. They got too smart. But the banks got their own trouble. They've written down the junk bonds and the insurance companies and the bank. It's like a house of cards. It's you worried. And yet, doesn't seem to bother the stock market, does it?
No.
That's another world. Another world. Nothing to do with that. So that's really what I got to say is it's been a lovely experience, you know, since the early 40s. Capable people are going to carry on. Well, it's a sound business with sound products and plants and people and balance sheet. They can't ruin it too much. So I keep saying I'll come back. So that scares nothing. That scares us, though. So
you won't be too far away.
They wanted me to stay here, which was nice. I didn't want to stay. I remember my father, I said to him, from 65 to 88, he said again, the corner office's door was open. I'd walk by if you were in town. No, you came to see me. I'd walk you by and he'd wave and I'd walk in and introduce you. Tell you why you're here. Sit down, he'd have a cup of coffee with. It was nice. And then when you leave, you say, what the hell are you doing here? What are you wasting your time on now? You should be out getting orders. Pretty well fine. So I decided to get out of here. Is that right? He would do that. So I decided I want to get out. I didn't want to be in their hair. Let them alone. They got their work to do. They'll do it their way. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your...
You got a copy of this?
Yeah, well, somewhere.
Did I give it to you? I'm going to make you a copy.
I have one here, yes.
You don't need the names of the employees. I'll give you a cab. I'll give you the insurance thing.
Oh, okay.
You got any property? I would try to buy that.
Right, that's fascinating.
How we set people out to look for it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending the time with me.